train, right?
Yes. I see the train. What about it?
And you have a parachute.
Got a parachute?
What do you expect me to do?
Well, just,
you know, jump.
Just
jump?
Yeah.
Benji, it doesn't work like that. I'm not that high. There's ledges sticking out everywhere. I'm going to hit them before the parachute even opens.
Benji, even if I could get the parachute open, I don't know if
I can make it across the valley and intercept and land safely on a moving train.
Do you copy?
Yes, I copy. Look, I'm just trying to help you, okay? I need you to take a step back and pull yourself together because I am under a lot of pressure right now.
Do you expect me to talk?
Episode 236 of Do You Expect Us to Talk. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to watch the latest Mission Impossible movie, Mission:Impossible-Dead Reckoning Part 1. Should you or any of your Do You Expect Us to Talk force be caught or killed, the Secretary will of course disavow any knowledge of your actions. This introduction will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Good luck both.
I would be very... I'd be reluctant to watch a film called Mission: I think it could be shit, quite literally.
Especially Mission Impossible, colon.
Yeah. That colon's impossible.
Impossible, colon.
How did they get that in there? It would be set in A&E.
Very painful movie.
So, yes.
There's no other introduction I could do. We're doing Mission Impossible. You've got to do that introduction, haven't you?
I know. For the seventh time.
Yes.
So, we covered the Mission Impossible series. I can't remember if we did it in the run-up to Fallout or just after Fallout came out. I'll just have a look, actually, and see if I can find out when it was. But it was some time ago. And in the time since then...
I was going to say, was it like one of those things where we like recorded the episode Fallout before we finished the series, and then or am I getting that mixed up with
that could
Captain
be.
Marvel?
That could be. We have done that with a couple of things.
I know we did. If I remember right now, we did it with Captain Marvel. But
we recorded Captain Marvel about 3 or 4 weeks before its place. We got ahead of the game on that one.
Yeah.
Mission Impossible. I'm looking at it. It's saying 4 years ago. That doesn't tell me very much unless I get the actual date. Doesn't matter. Anyway, yes, Fallout was, I think, another one. We recorded that, I think, just before Ghost Protocol. From memory.
Yeah.
And then we got to the end and we were like, oh, it's over already. Can we do a commentary? So we did Mission Impossible 2 commentary.
Yeah.
Also a commentary for, what was it? Tia Maria.
Tia Maria.
Oh, no. What was it? No, Troy. What was the other name? What's the other drink? It was Amaretto. It was Amaretto, starring Tom Cruise as Troy Amaretto. Yeah, that was it. So, they have been planning this for a number of years, not to come out with too many fun facts, but two of the ones we've sort of been looking at will probably come out during the course of this show. The first thing is, Tom Cruise was 57 when he started filming this, 59 when it wrapped, and he's now 61. We were recording a show some time ago where I made a joke about welcome to all our new Italian listeners because Northern Italy had been put into lockdown for COVID-19. And of course, we had no visibility that was going to happen here. We didn't realise we were only a few weeks behind Italy. We thought they were just mismanaging it. And it just turned out that's the way the world dealt with it. And that very day that Northern Italy was filmed in lockdown, Tom Cruise was trying to film this in Venice. So it's been going. He wasn't in Venice. And that leads to the sort of the second fact, if you like, that the whole reason we have a Rome section in this film is because they were supposed to go from Abu Dhabi to Venice, but Venice was locked down. So they had to go to Rome and film something instead. I don't know if it was an instead or they were going to film later in the schedule, but certainly that Rome section is what it is because they couldn't go to Venice. So that means we are at the seventh Mission Impossible film. So tell us about it, Becca.
Yes, so starring Tom Cruise, Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg, Hayley Atwell, Rebecca Ferguson, Vanessa Kirby, Tom Clementieff, sorry if I've ruined these names, Issa Morales, Henry Turney, plus Carrie Yours, Mark Gatiss, Indira Varma, both known for Big Finish and Doctor Who, and Rob Delaney in a serious role. I wasn't expecting to see either of those. Score by Lord Balfe, script by Christopher McQuarrie and Eric Jenderson, based on the original series by Bruce Geller, directed by Christopher McQuarrie.
Yeah, so I think the biggest shock in that regard is what the film's about, because suddenly, in the last 2 or 3 months, yeah, there's been warnings for years, but in the last sort of month or two, the whole discussion around AI, its capabilities, its rate of growth, its potential uses, has become a really hot topic. It's part of the writers' strike that they want, you know, assurances that AI won't be writing things for them. Makes me worry about how highly they value their own talents if they think a machine can do it better.
I think we found something online that we posted a while ago about, like, they asked ChatGPT to write an introduction about us. It named some really random people who we've
Yeah, but
of.
You asked it for a review as well, and it did the review correctly.
It really did, you know.
Apart from the fact
scary.
They thought we were, like, good in that.
And it also popped up on, I listened to the Jarenson podcast as well, and Jamie kind of asked ChatGPT to, you know, to do a review, and it sounded like something, like, a human would write. It was uncanny. So it's a little bit worrying.
It is, and I believe that it has a small role to play in the... because the whole thing around residuals in the actor's strike, you know, how much are you going to pay me in years to come when you stream things and so on. And, of course, you've got the issue of whether you can put people in an AI role. I mean, we sort of saw it in The Flash, in that you had sort of an AI a CG representation of... Christopher Reeve and Helen Slater and so on, although it didn't look very good. So it's a hot button topic, so to find that it was central to a film that started 4 years ago surprised me somewhat, but we are yet to hear the sort of 3 to 6 hours of Christopher McQuarrie on the Empire podcast, where maybe we'll find out this was all retooled on the fly. I don't know.
Yeah, you wouldn't be surprised, would you? Given how they kind of they approach it, don't they? They kind of like sort of film as they go and write and sort of like sort of take things at the spur of the moment.
Yeah.
Like I listened to him today, in fact, and apparently the one of the major sequences, the one at the airport, that was going to be done in Berlin.
Right.
That was like at the airport in Berlin or something like that. That whole sequence was going to be like at Berlin. But as it turns out, they couldn't get to film there because of obviously, because apparently security is like really, it's going to be really difficult because like, you know, security and everything, getting everything all signed off and closing everything down as well. Whereas like there was a new airport just built in Abu Dhabi, so they had like full reign of it all. So they didn't have to go through any of those complications. It was like, right, well, it's
well,
all set
it,
off.
Well, this airport not opened by this point?
No. So the airport that they're in like, Abu Dhabi, like, that had opened when they were filming it, so they had, like, full access, full reign of it, because it wasn't functioning at the time, so it was just, like, a lot easier. So, and then while they were there, they were like, we might as well shoot something in the desert. So that would have changed, like, the action sequence towards the beginning. With Elsa and whatnot, that like, that probably would have been done in Berlin, or they would have done something else in Berlin, or something along those lines. So I know that changed what the trajectory of like what the film was, but what that was originally, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. So, in terms of viewings, I've seen it once. That's all. I saw it on Saturday night. We're recording on Wednesday, or Saturday during the day, actually. We were delayed. Well, I was due to see it on the Monday. The day it opened, and I can't remember why I canned that now. But we didn't go. I think it was like we had an appointment before it, and it was all going to be a race. So we didn't bother. And so I pushed it later into the week. I went to see Elemental by myself the next day. I was holding off for like my wife to be able to see it. So I saw it on the Saturday during the day. And we're now on Wednesday. So I think we were supposed to record Sunday night. I think I've been the delay. I've been the delay tonight and I think yesterday. So I was at the point where much longer I'd have had to go for a second viewing.
Yeah, I think as things are, it's probably, yeah, I saw it on Monday on opening night, and just down to like work and other things, I haven't seen it since.
Yeah.
So it's just how, I would have liked to have caught it. I would have watched it again, but I will watch it again though shortly. But yeah, no, I've only managed to.
I haven't had a chance. I've had a couple of things going on in family over the last few days, so I haven't really been able to do anything. And then at the weekend, I was going to do a double bill of Oppenheimer and Barbie, but my wife wants to go to see Oppenheimer and doesn't want to see Barbie, so I'm going to have to see it another day. There's a possibility I could double bill whenever that is. So yeah, Oppenheimer this weekend, that will affect rewatches and so on. That's it. That was it for me in terms of viewing it. But Becky, you've seen it 3 times.
I have, unfortunately. That's why it's making good box office, you know.
Just from you?
I saw it obviously when it came out in prep for the show. And then we were sort of discussing it online with a JVR group. Yeah. And I was thinking, maybe there are a few things that I missed because my opinion sort of differed from everybody else. We all sort of came out of it thinking, oh my God. But yeah, I was kind of thinking. So yeah, we're to go and sort of see it a few more times again, and sort of, you know, prep for this evening show. And just sort of, you know, managed to spot a few things that I missed or perhaps I wasn't thinking about at the time. But yeah, as I say, it's probably not the best one in the series. Probably the biggest, but
well, it's hurt by being a part one. To some degree.
And it's not even the end of the series. Like, it was being queued up to, you know, part one and part two were going to kind of be the farewell to the series, but now that's not the case, so it's just not a problem.
I suspect it will be in a way, and here's my theory of where the series is going. I think after this will sort of like cement like the Tom Cruise Ethan Hunt character in the leading role, and it will be next Mission Impossible will be Mission Impossible starring Hayley Atwell and someone else and this and Tom Cruise. So it will be Tom Cruise as like the gym like lead the lead of the MI6, but might be less Ethan Hunt focused as the other series might be.
So he's like handing the baton on. Because
he'll be old. Yeah, he'll be the older, more experienced, but it might, you know. I mean, that's how I probably think is the best way to go about it, because you still have Tom Cruise and he can still be in it and do stuff. But you might, like.
You do wonder how long he can put his body through this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the body has its limits, and frankly, the limit, I think. For most people, if you look at fitness stats and they, you know, they always say that thing about taking a beat a year off your heart maximum heart rate is bullshit. They don't know where that comes from as an idea. Your cardiac output lessens, but it's a lot gentler than that. I can do much more than my theoretical maximum. The crux seems to be somewhere around 70. And you got to think he's 61 now. Now, maybe he will be like the exception that proves the rule. Maybe he will still be jumping off stuff at 75. But, you know, we'll have to see. It may well be you just change what the focus of the series is, as you've said. It may well be the stunt work is still there, but it's not him as much. I don't know. I know that they are rowing back on it, but at the same time, there's a part two. Could the outcome of that film be different and you throw people off the scent with, no, I want to keep going forever? Does Christopher McQuarrie want to make other films? Anything? He's been making Mission Impossible since 2015. And with the lead time and prep and everything else, in fact, he did some script doctor work on Ghost Protocol. At this point, it's getting
on. He did, uncredited.
It's like 12, 13 years of his life at this point. This is an Oscar-winning screenwriter, and I'm not looking down my nose at these films at all, but does he want to try anything else? So I don't think we can take anyone's word for it quite yet. But the other factor, I think, is let's see what the box office does, because it got off to a slightly slowish start and then picked up as the week went on. That could just be a reflection of the fact that it was Monday, folks. Everyone's got work the next day and it's a long film.
It was Monday.
Or it could just be we are at a major tipping point for cinema, because The Flash did badly. What's it called? What's the one with... Indy was the next one I was going to say. I could remember the name of that, but what was the one? Black Adam.
It performed poorly.
Black Adam didn't do that well. I don't think the last Shazam film did that well. Guardians did well, but it was saying goodbye to a character, you know, or a set of characters. I don't really know where the box office is at a real changing point. This film, this was the other fact I'm going to spill, is the budget for this is the highest of Tom Cruise's career, but it's the constant COVID delays. It's the doing all the logistics to go to one place and then having to go somewhere else.
He's paid for quite a lot of this out of his own pocket, hasn't he?
Well, the budget was $291 million, and I know you can tell them about money he spent a bit later on, actually, because I know there's some stuff around that knocking around. But £291 million, and I just wonder if we're getting to the point now that very, very, very few films are going to warrant that kind of investment. Because the sort of money you've got to do to justify that is getting massive. And there's no room for error. And, you know, they are tanking on lots of different films. Even the last Star Wars film did, like, half what the first of the sequel trilogy did. So we seem to have been... We've had declining returns for a while. We'll have to see on this. I think it'll do all right, actually. But it's just something to watch in the next few weeks. Mm. I'll just start with some first thoughts of my own. I think it's probably in the top half of the Mission Impossible films with the other Macquaries. Brad Bird's probably the first one. I think it's certainly better than... I think I prefer it to the first one. It's certainly better than 2, obviously. It's better than 3, which was a bit rote. I think Ghost Protocol, from memory, was really that Burj Khalifa stunt. I liked it a lot, but I think what Macquarie's done with the series is superior. I did feel the time of this film a little bit. Not a lot. It felt... People keep saying it whips through its runtime. It does, in that it's not like Indy, where I was like, gosh, this is taking ages and I'm really depressed. It was okay. There was just a couple of bits in the film, and maybe as we get to them, I'll say, well, after this bit of the film, it felt like it lulled a little. I don't think Hayley Atwell is as interesting a character as Rebecca Ferguson, and we're going to assume everyone who listens to this show has seen the film, or at least knows that plot point. I'll spell it out a bit more in a minute, but obviously it's going to be Hayley Atwell going forward, or at least for the next film. I don't find it anything like as interesting. And I was surprised, actually, because beforehand, objectively, I wouldn't have known. But when they were on screen, I'm far more attractive to Rebecca Ferguson as well. But she's just a more interesting character. She suits the series better. We'll see. There's room for development there. I felt there was some ropey dialogue, but I can't think of an example, which is frustrating, and another sign that I've not seen the film for a few days. And I also felt that the suddenly giving Ethan this sort of painful past and the women near you all die, sort of like they've done with the Craig era Bond, I thought is like, it's a bit soap opera-y 7 entries in.
Is Gabriel the author of all his pain?
Yeah, 7 entries in and we've never heard of this guy. Gabriel himself, interesting enough character, Isai Morales, or however you pronounce that name. I'm watching him at the moment because I've been doing a very long, very sporadic rewatch of NYPD Blue. And he's the boss of the detectives at the point where I'm watching it. He's about to leave. And he's about 40 at that point. He's about 60 now. So, but he's aged very well. I mean, he's just in that show. He had dark hair. Now it's grey in a bit. But he's a similar build. He's looking very well. But he's a very kindly chief of detectives. You know, it's very interesting to see him in this role. But I know he was in things like Ozark, which I haven't got round to watching yet. I will one day. So I know he's in that and some other things, but he's Tony Rodriguez from NYPD Blue for me. But yeah, so the callbacks were good. Seeing people like Henry Czerny again, and the idea that sort of all the American people are sort of together in this sort of security club. I forget what they're called now, but I'll get to it, I'm sure. Good cast. Good story. I do wonder whether this will, in 20 years, if we're all still here with the threats to this world, if we're all still here in 20 years, will watching this film be a bit like watching Sandra Bullock's The Net?
If AI hasn't blown us all up.
Has AI, is the conception of AI in this film like going to look laughably twee going forward? But I think the headline is, it's of a piece with the Christopher McQuarrie trilogies, or if you like, it's going to be a quadrilogy next year. You can't fully comment because it leaves story threads that may be answered well or might be answered very poorly. You know, Gabriel and his backstory might be great, might be terrible. He might not even be human. You know, there might be some silly backstory there that he's a bloody cyborg or something. I doubt it, but you never know. I am sorry that we're losing Rebecca Ferguson very much. I think that's a mistake. I don't think the set pieces... I think the set pieces overall are good, but the headline stunt. So think Burj Khalifa hanging off a plane. You know, the tandem jump between the buildings in Three. Mm-hmm. The version in the film is the jump off the cliff on the bike. That's the weakest we've seen in a Mission Impossible film for years, because they shoot it from above. It just didn't have any wow factor for me whatsoever. But as we've said with the Bond films, it's not always a bad thing to you know, to not be trying to outdo yourself every time, because that leads to silly places.
Well, I think in regards to, like I said, the last one, Fallout, I think the thing with the stunts is they kind of make the most of the fact that Tom Cruise actually does it.
Yeah.
So a lot of the promotional material for this beforehand was like showing you Tom Cruise doing this stunt.
Yeah.
So seeing it beforehand
ruins it.
So seeing it now is kind of a bit like, well, I've kind of already seen it.
Yeah. And it's just shot from above. I suppose that in IMAX you're seeing the distance he's falling.
Yeah.
But I just think that just take something away from it, and I'm not quite sure what. When I think back to Fallout, obviously the draw dropper is meant to be the Halo jump, but I was actually far...
That's the least memorable one.
Yeah, him going counter traffic round the Arc de Triomphe and then like being hit at that junction by the car where he flies over it, you know, where he hits the car and goes flying off his bike, all of that was,
I think, far, the helicopter far... stuff at the end, I think that was like
that
the...
as well. Well, for me, I thought the streets of Paris were the most interesting bits to
but
me.
But one of the biggest things that they made a thing out of, that was the fact that he broke his ankle while doing it, and that shot is still.
Yeah, he's still running as well. That's amazing.
Yeah, and that shot is still in it. So and they so I think regardless of what it is, it's not necessarily like here's the big stunt that they do.
Yeah.
I think it's the fact that Tom Cruise does lots of these things, lots of these crazy stunts.
Maybe. I just feel that when I watched the trailer and I saw them driving around the streets of what turned out to be Rome, but I glanced really quickly. I don't know if I missed a couple of landmarks, but it looked so like, and we saw a bit of them going round a roundabout, and I just thought, we just saw that in Fallout. So I was a bit worried this film wouldn't feel quite as fresh as last time out.
It's a little bit in Fast 10 as well.
It is, although what it does do, it does better than Fast 10, but it even uses that fountain, I think it's the Trevi Fountain, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's using a lot of the same locations. It's doing it better than the Fast films, but then these are higher quality films. I like the Fast films for what they are. I do. I enjoy them, and I don't look down my nose at them anymore. See our Fast series for details. I did once upon a time in my life. But this is a superior action franchise. It just is. So I think my headline would be, I think it's not as good as Fallout. I think you can argue the toss over Rogue Nation. I think I'm a bit concerned about where a few of the story threads are going. It's slightly too long, a little bit disjointed, but some of the sense of fun is back as well. They're back to using the masks and stuff, which they've let go of in the past. So a bit of a greatest hits Mission Impossible film, but I mean that in a good way. What about you guys?
I'll go next then.
Yeah.
I didn't feel it's running time at all. I think that's one of the things that that stood out to me first time round was the fact that I was watching it. I checked my watch just out of curiosity, not because I was actually bored. I was like,
"Wouldn't go as far as bored." Well, I will just clarify that I won't go as far as bored. I just noticed it a couple times.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's like I was never bored once for it.
Yeah.
But I was actually quite surprised how like easily that watch, because most of the times when something's like going on for 3 hours, you do start to get a little bit of like, you know, cramping your bum. You go.
I was getting bored.
Yeah, you do feel like there's a little bit of a lull, or there's a bit of there's something, but I don't really remember that. I mean, I think I could easily have, watched another 30, 40 minutes. No problem at all. So that's one of the things that stood out to me.
It's impressive they can take well-worn ground and make it fresh, because I was a bit concerned where I saw another fight on top of a train.
Yes. I mean, it's kind of like, was a few callbacks to the first one, wasn't there? I think a little.
They're not necessarily quoting Bond, Wolverine or anything else. Mm. Bear in mind, they had a train sequence in the first film and he went under tunnels and things like that.
I do think, and this is a bit more of it's a bit more criticism of the series as a whole, you know, because of it being too Ethan focused.
Yeah.
Like, I do miss, like, the other team members. Like, yes, we've got Simon Pegg and Luther. They're not in it as much this time around, probably due to COVID, and, you know, it's a part one as well, which we'll get onto.
Yeah.
But I do miss, like, why have we brought back any other like members? Why, you know, do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I get Elsa, yeah, great, but I've got a new addition as well. Hey, that well,
yeah.
But I just feel like, okay, Vig Rames, you know, no, with all due respect, you can tell he's like, you know, an old guy, so seeing him like, you know, sort of doing the best to try not to make him run around too much, it's just a bit, come on, you wouldn't. I know he's like sat down on the computer screen like majority of the time,
which totally encroaches on Benji's skill set.
Yeah,
we had this problem with the Fast franchise, didn't we? Because you had Tej, and then you brought in, I've forgotten her name now, the lady character from the last couple of entries. I haven't watched it for a few weeks, I've completely forgotten, but she's got the same skill set, and then you're trying to put them together. And Rebecca Ferguson wasn't going to be there to start with, so you had two techies and Tom Cruise.
Yeah, and again, it's like, whereas at least with, like, say, Ghost Protocol, you had, like, I had Simon Pegg, but you had, you know, Paula Patton, and you had Jeremy Renner, you know, sort of two other field agents who
balanced.
Yeah.
You know,
you could still sort of do stuff. So, there is that sort of element, which again, I think it says about where I hope the series goes after this, is to sort of like just mix it up a bit more.
But all we're saying is it's not a perfect film.
No.
Flaws don't matter though.
I'm picking its faults first. Mm. Other than that, there are some plot holes. Some things are a bit more. I'm not sure that makes entire sense. For example, the choice Ethan is made to choose, but in reality, it's like, what if Gabriel loses the fight? I mean, there's no guarantee that he would win. Like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
If he's like. Fighting with Grace, because, you know, well, he's experienced, you know, trained killer. Okay, yeah, I'll get why that's a losing battle.
Yeah.
But when it comes to Elsa, it's a bit.
Yeah, well, he's got a little knife and she's got a sword, and yeah.
Let's just assume for argument's sake that he's better than she is. There's still
very good chance that it could go the other way. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, yeah. we know how fights go. We've seen Elsa in previous film take down a guy like twice as big as her.
Yeah.
You know before. So it's
that's why she was such an upgrade on Paula Patton's character, because they really, really, really had the real deal this time.
Yeah. So that was like in the back of my mind, and they didn't sort of do enough to explain why that would be the case. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Okay, why would this guy be able to have the edge on? I mean, there's various different things you could do. You know, you could like sort of do sleight of hand. It could be a sniper. It could be a vice. No one knew about. You know, that kind of thing. You know, it's there's various ways you can get around that, but. You know, but when it results in a 1-1 fight, it's like, well, that's not like a controlled thing. Do you know what I mean?
No, I was saying, I don't think it's as bad as, say, an Orson and Kurtzman film where, or even J.J. Abrams himself, where it barrels along quickly so you don't think, and the moment you think it all falls apart. I doubt it's that bad, but as they are picking things up on the fly, I'm sure we will pick problems as we go through in order. And probably things I haven't even thought of as we're sat here now. I'll just go, actually, that doesn't make sense. I don't know how much of a problem it is. That, I mean, there are little goofs in the film, like, with that type of train, you got to keep feeding it coal. It should have just gently slowed down, that train. But we'll get to all that. But you liked it. That's the main thing. Let's get to the pluses.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say overall, apart from like the plot holes, and I think my main, if I have any main criticism, and you know, it's part of, it's the nature of it, it's a part one.
Yeah.
So you kind of walk away with like, I don't think I've watched a full film, even though you kind of like, you've been there for like 2.5 hours.
Although he wanted to leave it on a full on cliffhanger, Macquarie, but he said it was Cruise. He said to the audience, I've got to leave satisfied. We've got to, yes, you're leaving threads, but they've accomplished what they went for in this part of the story.
Yeah.
So they didn't want to leave it that way.
I don't mind. I mean, I kind of like. Fast 10 ended with a cliffhanger, but the problem with cliffhangers is it gets very EastEnders, doesn't it? It feels very much like.
Well, I think the thing with Fast 10 is I was a bit stunned. I was like, oh, it's finished. Like it wasn't set up to be a cliffhanger until a few seconds before it happened, and then you were like, "All right, you've told us enough film now." Have you? And Dom's pregnant, and only one of the babies is his. That's very soap opera-ish, and I thought they were getting close to that territory with, you know, the mystery in Ethan's past and women who get the tragedy that women get close to him die, and it kind of paints him as a bit of a lady killer, and yet. One thing Tom Cruise is, and I'm making no aspersions about the actor, I'm talking about the character of Ethan Hunt, he's quite sexless, really. I mean, he had a sex scene in with Tandy Newton in the second film, but I mean, we've never even seen him kiss Ilsa.
In that respect, he's almost like the anti-Bond, isn't he? Because Bond's known for sort of womanizing ways,
there's
whereas
a bit
Ethan
of a
Hunt,
hug.
Not so much.
The idea that he's, you know, all women get really loyal to him like he's irresistible and they end up dead. That's a James Bond trope, not an Ethan Hunt.
Yeah, I find that a bit hard to believe.
Yeah, so I'm not sure about that. So that's a bit soap opera-ish. Seven films in, trying to put that wrinkle into the Ethan Hunt character, because Ethan has barely been a character, really.
Well, Ethan Hunt's basically teacher Tom Cruise himself.
Yeah,
essentially.
In fact, he's probably the only Tom Cruise character you don't call Tom Cruise, except for Maverick.
Yeah.
Because, honestly, when Tom Cruise is in a film, even Jerry Maguire, I'll say, and then Tom Cruise does this. And the film's named after his character.
Yeah.
He's Tom Cruise in all of his films.
Yeah, he does.
But generally speaking, I liked everyone in it. I liked Hayley Atwell, though it's a bit hard because she is a new face. And she's very different because she's... I think what the problem you've had, Dave, is she at one point she's very much like confident and professional as a thief,
yeah,
and then it very quickly switches to completely out of debt,
completely novice,
like,
agent, effectively.
I'm a complete like an innocent civilian kind of thing.
And the Impossible Missions Force. Now that's another factor I'm not that fond of. but I gave it a pass. It doesn't affect my enjoyment of the film. But you'd assume the Impossible Missions Force would be that stereotyped best of the best of the best of the best. And in fact, in Mission Impossible 3, Simon Pegg's just an analyst trying to get his field license, if you like. And in this film, they're like misfit criminals given a chance at redemption. I mean, she's gone into the Impossible Missions Force, and what is she? Effectively a decent pickpocket? That's odd.
Yeah.
And you can guarantee in part two she'll be like a fantastic fighter, and just think they've gone in a couple of directions which maybe they have to because it's film seven and you've got to keep trying to show us something new. But those are soap opera-y elements that I wish weren't there.
The aspect I do like about that, though, and I understand that is a genuine criticism, but the aspect I do like about it, you know, or at least the potential of it, is to establish a skill set for future characters. So let's say in the future, what the films like, hey, yeah, well, she's the thief of the group, and the other one's like the tech guy. Each one's got their own thing. Do you know what I mean? And
yes,
you know,
that will make sense.
And that is like,
they used to do that better. To start with, Ving Rhames was on the computer. Later, it was Benji. Paula Patton would go in and draw the male gaze, although she was good at fighting as well, and so on. That's lessened a bit, definitely. I mean, the only one where it was a little bit muddy was Jeremy Renner was effectively a clone of Cruise, because we didn't know if he was replacing Cruise. Or of Ethan Hunt, anyway. So, yeah, that could be the case. I did find it funny. It did remind me of Mission Impossible 3, because you never really knew what the rabbit's foot was. The plot point in this might as well just be called MacGuffin.
Yeah, it's just another MacGuffin, really, isn't it?
The key.
The things that the police and detectives want, but the audience don't really care. But I think, yeah, the key in this case was another MacGuffin, rabbit's foot style.
Yeah, I mean, it does have a use, and we'll find that out in part two, but it's just about them getting the key at this point. We think it opens source code, but for three quarters of the film's running time, we don't even know that.
No.
It's just something they have to have. So
it's something they teased, isn't it? And they've got to find it, so...
Becca, tell us what you think of it.
Yeah. yeah, it's a bit sort of commodian, my review, almost a little bit, although not quite lofty heights of it. I mean, it's still amazing. I think certainly the one thing that the series is known for is action set pieces. I would probably say, like, I mean, they're known, you know, sort of really, really impressive stunts. They're probably just going to get bigger and bigger until...
They'll never top the Burj Khalifa, though.
Until Cruise's body gives out, basically.
They'll never top the Burj Khalifa, though.
I kind of think they have. That motorcycle stunt, bloody hell. That just topped it for me, for sure.
Did it?
All right. I was just like, I left that cinema thinking, excuse my language, fuck. You know, basically, like, oh my gosh. And to sort of misquote Quentin Tarantino, they sold me a seat, but I literally only used...
I didn't think fuck. I thought cheesy comestibles, but I saw it during the days. So it was before the watershed. So I thought cheesy comestibles. If I'd seen it in the evening, I'd have thought fuck.
No, this is it. Cheesy comestibles all the way, madam. But yeah, no. But basically, WTF, Madam Farmer, all the things. Just to show the scope and scale of those scents. Oh my gosh, yeah, they keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Obviously, it's one of those things. The trailer gave quite, you know. Gave most of, not all, the stunts away, and obviously being a Bond fan in that community, all the reaction was obviously that's from this film, that's from that film. I mean, it's a coincidence at the end of the day. Obviously, Mission Impossible sort of came from Bond, as did Bourne, you know, lots of other sort of, you know, Man from U.N.C.L.E., a lot of other kind of spy thrillers and everything of the 60s of that era. So they're all going to sort of feed into each other, really, especially like Bond and Bourne and Mission Impossible, called known for these really epic sort of grandiose stunts, and with Tom Cruise as well. I mean, say what you want, you know, he's got quite a colourful personal life, quite sort of colourful history, but obviously between this and Top Gun, and obviously being, you know, the sort of the figurehead for the Mission Impossible series, he kind of really has sort of, or he's certainly tried to keep sort of cinema going, in terms of trying to do everything, like a lot of in-camera stunts, doing things for real, multiple times, you know, just trying to get it right, and trying to, you know, literally each time working out his own way of doing things, trying to figure out if someone's never been committed to film before, he'll work out a way of doing it, which is really admirable. So yeah, whatever you think of him, sort of personal and just Scientology beliefs and one thing or another, you kind of got to admire him for that, for sure. It's just mind-blowing. As you mentioned, David, the fact that he's kind of entering into the 60s, you think, oh, my life is just incredible, really. So props, you know, props to him and his team. And you've seen, like, you know, you'll see interviews with Simon Pegg and Hayley Atwell, just thinking, yeah, they were there. And, you know, Simon Pegg has often said in his interviews, I think, how is he going to do this? What the hell? Oh, my God. You know, they're just kind of watching dumbstruck, basically, that he's actually going to throw himself off a cliff, you know, in the name of an epic stunt. Just think, oh, my God. So that's kind of why I, you know, obviously the Burj Khalifa stunt is incredible. And you sort of think, how are they going to top that? But that's kind of like, for me, those kind of stunts do top it. I mean, it's certainly up there. But this is probably one of the biggest and best stunts I've ever done, considering he's got to land on a moving train.
That is a positive way to look at it, that
yeah. They're
doing something right. If you can get this deep into the series and have favourites, do you know what I mean? That, like, my favourite's the Burj Khalifa, your favourite's something else, and so on. And Chris might say the helicopter, for example. So that's a big positive, yeah.
But you know, yeah, well, especially because it is one of the highest points kind of in the land as well. I mean, obviously the motorbike stunt is probably not that high up. But in terms of, like, the Burj as a structure being seen, it was one of the highest sort of structures.
It was very, like, get on the plane.
Yeah, get on the, literally. And I think I'd probably say, like, the Burj, this latest stunt, and then the plane are probably, like, my top three, for example, if we're doing a ranking. But, yeah, no, I can't really add too much to what you guys say, really. I did enjoy it. I didn't really feel like it's runtime. I probably, unlike you, Chris, I probably couldn't have watched any more. The dialogue as well, I'd say it was more lots of Basil exposition, really. A lot of kind of talking heads, but luckily the way that it was shot, a lot of kind of Dutch angles made, you know, chopped it up and kind of made it less boring. Probably could have done without a lot of Basil exposition popping up. Casting was great. I really wasn't expecting to see Mark Gatiss, Indira Varma, Rob Delaney at the start, Carrie Yules as well at the start. I knew he was in it a little bit, but I didn't quite know what role he would play.
Took me about. He's in it for about 10 minutes at the start, isn't he?
Yeah, literally. He pops up on the train.
It took me nearly the whole 10 minutes. If it's 10 minutes at the start to place him, even though he's quite well known, took me ages. Yeah. I was going, who on earth is that?
It was one of those things. It's like seeing Hugh. What's his face in No Time to Die? I was sort of like, oh, okay. Didn't know who's going to be in it, but it's a pleasant surprise. And yeah, same with Mark Gatiss and Indira Varma as well, both known if you're a Doctor Who fan, or if you're a League of Gentlemen fan, or even if you're a big Finnish fan. I'm sadly just getting into them. What's taking me so long? I know. Both kind of known for their voice work on Doctor Who and various other big Finnish series as well. So it was amazing to see them.
Have never seen The League of Gentlemen, particularly, it's the most unique take on a sketch show, comedy sketch show you'll ever see, because it's a sitcom. It's a sketch show in a sitcom environment with massive overtones of horror.
Fantastic. Highly check it out, definitely. If you're in the UK and haven't seen it, do check it out. It will probably be on iPlayer. If you're not in the UK, get on the VPN, check it out if you can. It's well worth your time. It's very black humour and also quite niche humour as well. Especially if you're in the UK, if you're fans of Inside Number 9, the great anthology series, it's from the same team. Do check that out as well. So yeah, I highly recommend that. But yeah, just completely surprised by seeing Mark Gatiss, Indira Varma and Rob Delaney on there as well. Also great to see Henry Shirley as well. Great, Katrina returns as well after an absence of nearly 30 years. Going into this film, I kind of tried to find more out about, like, the technical side of it and the stunts and that sort of thing. I wasn't too quite sure about who was going to be in it. I sort of tried to stay away from all the cast. They're different to Bond, where I'm like, I've got no self-control and I must know everything about it. But with this one, I just thought, we'll just see. So that's kind of why it was a bit of a surprise to me. I didn't feel this runtime. Sorry, it's all a bit stream of consciousness, I'm afraid. I should organise my thoughts better, but never mind. Amazing action. You know, you're literally just going to be on the edge of your seat the whole time. Didn't really feel its runtime. Dialogue, a little bit too Basil exposition for me anyway. And there's other ways they could do show, don't tell. But there's quite a lot of backstory. Samurai is definitely He's quite a chilling villain for sure. Again, like his backstory does feel a little bit shoehorned in. What's his connection to Ethan? Hopefully we'll find out next time.
Whatever plus, they fucking know, make up by next year, they probably haven't worked it out yet.
I know, he's probably still writing it. He's probably still writing it as we speak.
Or whatever he thinks it is today, if they're still filming, it could slightly change.
It could change, that's it. You might get Nicholas Holt
back. Do you remember when they talked about part four? When said about Jeremy Renner thinks he's killed Julia.
Yeah.
And they said they had him use dialogue that could have been either way. They hadn't even worked out that it was Julia and whether he knew.
No, that's it. They could have shot like two different versions. You just
don't know. You don't know what about next year's installment is written in stone and what isn't.
It's all up in the air, and it could change as well. See how it goes. It's like kind of an organic kind of process as well. Nicholas Holt, he was originally going to play the villain, but obviously couldn't due to his commitments on The Great, I believe.
See, that would have like completely changed the aspect of the character, because
it would have done, because he's a lot younger.
Yeah.
So it's 30 years ago, when he was about four,
he killed Tom Cruise.
He stabbed a woman with his dummy or something.
Death by pacifier.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's pacifier for Americans.
How could they de-age Nicholas Holt, but going back to being a baby?
Would have just gone a different angle or something.
Gone down a different route. That's all massively changed the dynamics of the film. Sam Rose definitely. As you say, kind of known for playing sort of like a kindly character, and obviously popping up as a villain in Ozark as well. It just shows that he's a bit of a sort of chameleon type actor. He sort of plays a lot of like kind of looks as well. Like, he is very handsome, but also a fox, if I must say so myself.
I mean, to me, it just shows that, like, my thought was like thinking about the way the bomb producers take things. Like, we don't need to go for like a name. We do not need to go for like, oh, he's hot right now. It's like, I haven't seen this. I haven't seen this guy before at all. I mean, obviously he's been in stuff, but
I've seen him in one thing.
Yeah,
and that one thing, nearly 20 years ago.
But it doesn't matter, because he's good here.
Yeah.
And he's good in this role.
Yeah.
I don't need to have seen him before. I don't need to go like, oh yes, of course. We don't need it. Like, that's what's kind of frustrating sometimes about Bond is, do not need a name. We just need someone decent.
Who's hot right now?
I think he does. He does the job. He's quite sort of quite attractive and sort of deadly kind of way. He's quite sort of underhanded and insidious as well. Like, he never, well, apart from maybe in the airport and then obviously when he leaves the train. But otherwise, you just see him appear. You don't see him go in. You don't see him come out. And he's just kind of there. Like, when spoiler alert, when he's the CIA director, like, he's just there behind the door. How did he get there? How long has he been there for? It's a little bit weird. Just imagine if he appears, and I find him very, very, very creepy.
Yeah.
And also, if you look at his like colour psychology as well, the main colour that's associated with him is red, which is obviously one of like danger, one of blood. He's an assassin.
I think of white when I think of him.
Well, exactly, yeah, because he is Angel Gabriel, but he's Angel of Death.
I'd not even thought Angel Gabriel.
Which is going a bit far.
Well, no, I think of it because he tends to be dressed in white most of the time. I don't know.
No, that's it. Or like lighter colours for sure. Compared to like Ethan, obviously he's an agent. He's in the shadows. He wears a lot of black, dark colours, things like that.
Yeah.
Obviously the White Widow as well, because she is the White Widow. Which kind of leads me on to my next point. Now, I am all for more female characters. Fantastic. Here, I think there might be a bit too many. I'm really sorry. Hayley Atwell, she's fantastic, whatever she does. I've got no problem with it, but this is going to sound really, really bad. But, I kind of feel like she took away from Ilsa a little bit. Rebecca Ferguson, obviously fantastic. I mean, all the ladies in this film were fantastic. Pom Clemente, I felt, was very underwritten. There was an article in probably The Guardian or something like that.
Yeah.
I think she was.
I should have mentioned her as a negative, but I forgot her. That tells you.
I kind of felt like she was good.
I mean, basically, she was basically playing silent henchman or henchwoman.
Yes,
you know what
of
mean?
Course.
She was fine for that.
That was all, really. That was all. I mean, there's a silly article in when let's say lefty newspaper. I think it was The Guardian or something like that, for example. I'm lifting myself, but just facing, obviously, if you know, if you're an Asian character, basically you're you know, silent or don't really have much in the way of lines, that sort of thing. It's a bit of a trope.
I think... saw that on social media, but the thing I think the problem with that is that I think Guardian kind of out themselves as a bit like, not to put the whole race car thing, but as a bit of a racist idea, because who thought that anyway?
Who thought what?
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, I agree.
She's cast. If you look her up on Wikipedia about character, it says French assassin.
Mm-hmm.
So well, basically,
exactly.
her ethnicity isn't mentioned at all, and in this film,
she's French. She speaks very little English. She speaks largely French. I mean, herself, she's half French, half Korean.
I'm looking for the article now, actually, because really, I've got the Guardian in front of me.
I'm sorry to offend anybody with this argument, but I must say I don't think it applies to her character in this sense, just because I don't think she's coded as Asian. I do apologise. No offence meant. But I just feel like she's really underused. Of all the female characters in this film, she kicks ass. You know, she's a really determined character. She's always, you know, bring her to me, sort of thing. She doesn't give up. She's totally, you know, committed and determined. And she can hold her own in a fight. For sure, like that scene, like in the narrow alleyway between her and Tom Cruise. I'm just going to call him Tom Cruise. I kind of feel like, oh my god, you know, is he really gonna lose it? She's very deadly as well, and she uses all aspects of her body and her personality as well to try and ensnare him. That fight in the alleyway is quite brutal.
If you know which part of a woman's body will ensnare Tom Cruise, write to us and expect us to talk at gmail.com.
She's quite good in the fact that her performance is silent, and then she's very much like, I'm very much determined and quite enjoy being violent as well.
She doesn't really need to say a lot though, does she?
Let's face it. I mean, she doesn't. But my only problem with her is the potential direction. As like, I don't want it to sort of turn good. Do you know what I mean? I just thought that angle was like, I was hoping that she would how they ended it with her is like, all right, well, she's fine, she helps Tom Cruise the end, but then she just dies, but I don't want to sort of like survive and end up being a reformed goodie. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
it's a bit of a trope, isn't it?
Sounds a bit lame to me. It's like, I'd rather she just would, if you're gonna do that, I'd rather she'd have died there and then. So, but you know, I guess we'll wait and see.
All female characters are really great. I kind of felt like she was a bit underused. Spoiler alert, Elsa dies. I wonder if she is really dead. I'm not quite sure. But I like the fight scene between her and Gabriel on the bridge. I thought that was the kind of the two fights juxtaposed. but it's really, really well done, well choreographed, and you kind of really feel. I kind of feel like it was like, stop trying to hit me and hit me sort of thing. Like, it was really quite close. That was kind of like being my only criticisms, really. Quite a busy populist film. Maybe chop one character out. No offence. A lot of Basil exposition. But otherwise, yes, it's a long film. But for me, I didn't really feel that it did kind of zip through a little bit. It's kind of like not my favourite Mission Impossible, but it's certainly top tier for sure with the later films. I didn't really care about the MacGuffin, and obviously a lot of the stunts did remind me of, like, you know, the sort of yellow fear obviously reminded me of, obviously, from the Lupin movies, and also Fear Eyes Only. And there are aspects of it which called back for me back to, like, Tomorrow Never Dies, other previous Bond stunts. Obviously GoldenEye is the big one. Bond 77 and The Spy Who Loved Me, we skis off the edge of a cliff and parachutes, I just you know, really enjoyed it. I had a fabulous time, and can't wait for part two, basically. Yeah, sorry about my ramblings there.
No,
apologies if I offended anybody. I didn't mean it at all.
Nothing you said was offensive.
That's just my opinion.
What is this Guardian article then, before we go any further? What was it saying?
It was basically, correct me if I'm wrong, Becca, it was basically sort of like criticising the tropes of having, like, Asian women,
the
as
ethnic
hedge women.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so,
well, basically, Asian characters in general kind of being coded as like silent or having very little dialogue.
Is who's thinking that when seeing her in this film? because
it never occurred to me.
Yeah, exactly. It's
yeah,
like,
that's it, precisely. And also, so, it would be interesting to see, like, obviously we've got Barbie coming up as well. Simu Liu is in that, so I don't know what role his Ken has to play. Like, how much dialogue does he have compared to all the other Kens?
The point is, what would people of the same ethnicity as her think? I think that's the most important thing. But at the same time, how many films have I seen that in? Your first thought goes to Kill Bill Volume 1. But
yeah,
I can't think of that many.
Die Hard 4?
Yeah, okay.
I mean...
I'm struggling.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of Asian films, to be fair.
Well, it's a trope in general, certainly in terms of Western cinema. It is a bit of a trope, but I think
bad guys.
Yeah.
Well, there are. I mean, here I don't think it applies, unfortunately. I mean, I do kind of see where the author article is coming from for sure. I do think it's a problem. It's a trope, and it does need to go away because it's not right 100%. You know, it's something that does need to be addressed.
Is that much of a trope, though?
I don't know. Is it?
But I just don't think it applies to this film. Generally,
to be fair, the same newspaper gave this film a 5-star review, to be fair.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're against it completely. It's some think piece by one of their contributors.
Yeah, somebody's kind of written an article, which is fine. You know, it's a free country, free speech and everything like that, but I just don't think it applies. I do kind of see where they're coming from.
Right.
It is a trope and it is a problem, okay. But I just don't think it applies
I do have that bookmarked, that paper, so I do see some of the stuff, but I never saw that. Okay, and with that, I suppose, shall we discuss this film sequentially?
Yes, so it all starts very, shall we say, Spy Love Me / Through Eyes Only, doesn't it? A little bit.
The cup, why are the cups wobbling? What's going on? I can't see anything.
Jeremy
on
Bullock isn't in this film.
A little bit of the Hook with October and 2001 Space Odyssey.
Well,
Odyssey.
Odyssey, yeah. Space
also
Oddity was
any other film that's
song.
Set in a sub.
No, I think you're right with The Hunt for Red October, both in the sort of colour and the palette of it, but also the fact that it is Russian speaking in English with a Russian accent, isn't it? Or did I just forget it was subtitled?
Yeah, they start off in speaking Russian. It's kind of like overdubbed almost. And then it kind of goes from the subtitles into English.
Well, that's
accents,
like, to
so
be
I'm
fair, The
sure.
Hunt for Red October does that, doesn't it? He's talking, and then it sort of goes in on his mouth, and then he's speaking, a bit like Star Trek VI, where it becomes clear they're actually talking one language, we're hearing it another.
So you need to put the baby fish in your ear and can hear that language.
But I cannot watch anything like this without thinking of The Spy Who Loved Me. But thinking back through the films to date, is this the first sort of opening sequence, apart from 2, which has Tom Cruise in it, like the spot from Russia with Love style, the actor but not the character, is this the first without Ethan straight away? I can't remember.
I think the only one which does, I mean, well, the first one is it reveals that it's Ethan,
yeah,
isn't it? Because they pull the mask off.
That's right.
The second one does that reverse, so it's Tom Cruise. Don't you find out that it isn't?
Yeah, it's.
But I don't know if you want to include that. It does go to him climbing the mountain.
Yeah.
After that. So.
Yeah, I mean,
we
see Ethan before the titles, but the titles are ever deeper into this film, and it reminded me. I'm presuming we will get something with Empire again. He's, or with the Q&A or something like that, where they will talk about this. But he talked about it last time, and he said. He was aware that this is Macquarie, by the way, I'm talking about. He was aware it was taking longer and longer to get to the titles. And he said, last time, we're going to get there quicker, and it just took longer. And I thought of it this time. It took forever to get to the titles this time.
Yeah. And I think there was some sort of contemplation about, like, whether this would be in it. But I think they definitely wanted some sort of, like, we need to establish...
I've misspoken.
What's the AI called?
The Entity.
The Entity.
Which is just a Barbara Hershey film to me. But there you go.
Yes.
The
original Paranormal Activity.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the one. It's quite
hard hitting in places, actually. But there you go. The Entity is
directed by the same guy who did Superman 4, Quest for Peace.
What, Sidney J. Fury?
Yes.
Well, that's right, a drop-off in quality, isn't it?
He did some in, though, because I'll never forget that name. I'll never forget that's the director of Superman 4. But I sort of misspoke earlier in this show, actually. Because all the characters don't know what the key's to, I think it's quite easy to sort of forget yourself that it is directly this submarine rather than them just holding on to it. So we do know, yeah. But you're encouraged not to think about it. I'm not sure, with that in mind, it's the right decision, although I did forget. But if through the... We're not usually a step ahead of the characters, are we? And I'm not sure about that as a decision. You could
We're sort of travelling along with them.
I'm not sure where else you'd put it, but this it has the hallmarks of Macquarie, just moving stuff all over the place to, like, where does it best fit? It doesn't ruin the film, but yeah, I think I know immediately. I don't know if it's because this was trailed about being AI, but it's quite clear they were getting false readings on an enemy craft. Yeah. And they fire a torpedo. How it quite comes back to them, I don't know. Is it an Australian craft? It's a boomerang one.
It's a boomerang. Maybe the AI sends it that way. But it does remind me of Tomorrow Never Dies a little bit. And now I'm wondering why the torpedo hasn't exploded. It does sort of remind me. I get Tomorrow Never Dies vibes from this pre-title sequence.
Yeah. And I don't know what I think about this. There's very few poor effects in this film. I just think... There's a few of them with this, with the sort of submarine sinking. I'm not quite sure why it sort of explodes. It doesn't explode, sorry, quite.
I think it's pretty cool. Like, the visuals...
Yeah.
I think, the only thing... Like, for this entire film, I think the visuals all hold up, the special effects.
Yeah.
And you get any sort of CGI-generated effects. There's maybe one scene, one very quick scene during the car chase that looks a bit but other than that
one or two, nothing major, but as I say, I'm getting the irony is 5 years ago I'd have picked more fault with it, but we're getting so used to shitty CG now that, like, standards have started to go backwards, so when a film's competent you're like, okay.
But, X had some really dodgy CG.
Yeah,
I think.
Nearly every film does now. Marvel being the worst offender. Well, I say the worst offender. The Flash was the worst offender.
Yeah, I've not seen that one, unfortunately. But in terms of, like, the modern tentpoles at the moment, I think Fast X has quite a lot.
Well, the Flash, I laughed. I laughed out loud in the cinema, which I don't do very often, even at fucking comedies, let alone.
Oh, no, yeah, because I remember you online, we were chatting about it, and I think you and One Ringer with Key the Music
Home. It was
Then it was like Die Another Day. Was it that one?
You asked if it was that bad, and I said, yeah, it is.
You say it is,
I haven't seen stuff like that since An American Werewolf in Paris. There's a falling baby sequence in it I laughed at. You're not supposed to be laughing at that point.
No.
And then they say it's a stylistic choice, and I think bullshit it is. or if it is, you should never work again. But the only thing I will say, slightly negative here, is I'm not sure about this visual representation of the entity as we go along. I couldn't help but think of the Epidemic virus from Red Dwarf. I don't know that that's a good thing.
Oh dear!
Which
is
that one? Which one's that?
It's the one where Dave has to have his arm cut off, and then they regrow him another one. It goes straight into back in the red.
Is that the one where he becomes like sentient virus?
It's a sentient virus. That's going to kill him, and then
But those effects are terrible, but because it's the BBC budget.
So we basically see a sub sink itself, and there's stuff about keys. And we know that it unlocks something here. The bit I was true on, I don't think they start talking about source code and stuff at this point, but that is revealed fairly quickly in that they talk about how we infiltrated all these places with it and now it's become sentient. And I think it's pretty obvious. Then we've got I think this film's a bit lighter than what we've had for a while. Exhibit A, the face masks. And whilst you've always had the odd funny line from Simon Pegg, you know, him just jump off the cliff is very like jump on the plane. I do think that this rookie MIF agent delivering supposedly pizza is a little bit goofy.
Yeah, I think he's meant to be though, isn't he?
Yeah.
And I think there are lots of light moments in this film. Like, for example, they finally crack the IMF, the other IMF. International Monetary Fund. They finally cracked that joke after nearly 30 years. It's about bloody time. which is quite funny. And there's a lot of actually sight gags, a lot of like physical comedy in this film, because a lot of it, you know, Tom Cruise is kind of interviews Rose kind of said, you know, a lot of his influences do come from really early silent films. And sort of like, you know, a lot of physical comedy and stuff like that. So there's a lot of that in the film, if you know where to look. But yeah, I would agree with you, Dave. Definitely is. There's a lot, you know, it's a lot lighter, a bit more funnier. Maybe not through and through comedy, but there are a lot of lighter moments.
So the mission this time. The mission this time is the key. It's in two halves. One half of it is in the possession of Ilse Furst, who has a bounty on her head, and basically the governments of the world are chasing her. And that the mission involves someone from Ethan's past. Do we see at this point who it is? Do we see that it's Gabriel?
I don't think so, because I think we all we get is a flashback to something.
Okay.
And I can't remember what triggered
it. Quite sort of early on, there. Well, a little bit further on, there is that kind of brief flashback to Tom Cruise with this woman, and then there's like de-aged Gabriel. But it's literally like the flashiest of flashes.
All the women we've encountered in this series, and they couldn't have retconned a different death. Or they couldn't have had it be Paula Patton, but she died off screen or something.
Is it somebody? I think it's meant to be somebody from like before he was offered the choice, in inverted commas, before he became an IMF agent.
Astounded me is it almost kind of like acknowledges Tom Cruise's age for a bit, because it's like it says it was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So
you've got to be at least late 50s.
Yeah.
Really. All right, Tom Cruise for a while was a bit ageless. Even if you said he was in his mid 20s at the time, he'd have to be like 53, 54. Yeah.
Yeah. Like at the most generous, you could say this is we're watching a Tom Cruise at 16, which is
not
really. He didn't look any different.
Not really. He'd be 46. So
that day when you were interrupted during PE, at school. Yeah. All right. So it is.
Ethan. To the headmaster's office.
This all moves quite quickly now. Ethan goes to the desert, which I read is Namibia. I can't remember if it tells us on screen. He's looking for Ilse.
It's near the Yemeni border or something like that, isn't it? So probably not Namibia.
Okay.
Just because I saw it recently.
Yeah, you've seen it more recently than me. I am using the help of some plot outlines here as well. Let's see what it says on the other one. Hang on a minute. See if they both agree. No, it's just saying. It just says Arabian Desert. Okay, so it's not likely to be there. Yeah, okay. So he does get the half key, but this is a bit of a. This reminded me of Star Trek 2, the Fakok, because I've been saying offline to these two for a while that having seen the trailer, I'll lay a fortune that Ilse dies. And of course, we get the Spock early in Star Trek 2 Fakok.
I thought that for later on in the film. It's like, well, they've already faked out a death once before, they're not going to do it again.
It was only that in the trailer you saw a couple of images of her with the eye patch on, and you only saw her in like one or two things. There wasn't much of her, and then it was all Hayley Atwell, and I just thought that does sound like an act one death. It isn't really, it's more of a sort of act two death, but it's the eye patch. I just assumed she'd been injured or something. It isn't that. Apparently the actress can't blink. She can't wink, sorry. She can't close one eye, so they put the eye patch on. And we know, so we've got this meeting of the US intelligence community. Now this is Carrie Elwes, who's basically Secretary of State, I think. Or Director of National Intelligence.
Chief of Intelligence, isn't he, pretty much?
Yeah, sorry, Director of National Intelligence.
I still remember him, obviously, like, Saw. But the Princess Bride, I think that's probably, like, over here, that's probably, like, the biggest role that he's known for, or sort of, you know, sort of romantic.
He'll always be Robin Hood for me.
Robin Hood, of course.
You forget he's British. Did you see Last Train to Christmas?
No.
This was Michael...
It was on Sky, I need to check that out.
This was a Michael Sheen film that came out last Christmas. Michael Sheen... Most of you listening should know who he is, but he's a British actor, and a lot of the stuff he's appeared in has been on telly. He was in the Underworld films, but he's also a bit of an impressionist in that he's played Tony Blair a couple of times. He's played the football manager Brian Clough. He's played David Frost in Frost Nixon. That's probably what he's best known for.
I think he's really popular in the David Tennant series, the Neil Gaiman adaptation.
Okay, I've not seen that. What's it called? Good Omens.
Yeah, Godome, is that the one? Yep.
Okay, forgot about that because I've not seen it. He's also played Chris Tarrant, the sort of original British host of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and stuff like that. So he's very good at that, and he plays a nightclub owner. He gets on this train and it's like 1985, and he's very much meant to be Peter Stringfellow. He's got hair like him. He's got a young, sort of very young, not criminally young, much younger than him, second wife. And he's just about to sort of open some more clubs. He's got a couple clubs and he's opening a few more. And his brother is there and warning he's, you know, overstretched himself. And it's all very British Midlands. And Cary Elwes plays his brother. You forget he's British. And you would not recognise it as him. And the story is, it's a bit of an It's a Wonderful Life Scrooge type time travel thing. Because when he goes backwards in the train, he goes back a decade. And when he goes forward, he goes forward a decade. And as he goes backward and changes things, he goes forward and his future has changed and things like that. I really liked it.
I just didn't watch it, but I need to check him out. But yeah, you forget. Yeah. I just looked him up. Born in London, apparently. You sort of forget that he is.
I always thought he was American, but just could do a really good British accent.
Yeah, same. Yeah. Admittedly the same. But I mean, he's quite good here. I mean, he's kind of quite smooth, but also quite slimy.
But this is the funny thing is, he's the director of National Intelligence, but he's not heard of the IMF. He makes a joke about it.
But these people aren't very good at their jobs, are they?
But he's sort of, this sort of grouping loosely formed the entity anyway. Eugene is like, Kittredge is like CIA director here. Not once is he named as the director of the IMF. So whether they just haven't come to that, he's doing both, I don't understand. Because later in the film, Hayley Atwell's going to have to go to him to be appointed to the IMF. So that's all a little bit
unclear. Yeah, well, that's kind of how it ends, doesn't it? It kind of ends with saying, hello, you know, you're the man I can trust.
It sounds kind of like Hush Hush off the books. Something that he runs, but like
But it's not consistent. In previous films, when we met whatever she's called, who was Henry Cavill's boss in the last one, they all knew who the IMF were. And Benji in part three is an analyst. It's like a desk-based job with field operatives, much like an MI6. Here, it's this kind of, you leave subtle calling cards to these people who have shaky pasts and they can choose to get involved or not. There's a mild retcon going on here. It's a much smaller and less official organisation than it's been to this point.
Could be a things to come in future, maybe, but unless it's just just how
here they this is basically the exposition, isn't it? This is where we get an explanation of what the entity is.
Yeah.
Designed to sabotage digital systems. Go in, learn, disrupt, infiltrate. It could be defense, it could be intelligence networks, but it's gone rogue and achieved sentience.
Isn't what they all do these days, just go rogue? That seems to be the plot.
The world, in its hubris, thinks it can get hold of this thing and control it. Ethan seems to be the only one smart enough to say it needs to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And even Kittredge doesn't necessarily think it should be destroyed. Because he seems to be pulling duty between IMF and CIA, and they want different
things.
Yeah,
he's kind of got a split. He's pulling the double duty there, isn't he, pretty much?
Yeah.
Trying to find that balance.
So, we have not seen masks for a while, have we? When did we last see a mask that worked? Because in 4, the machine didn't work, so they had to pretend to be... They just had to play the characters without the masks when they were in the Burj Khalifa. In 5, I can't remember. In 6... Henry Cavill smashed the computer that would have made it. I don't think we've had masks for a while, so we've got.
I think this is meant to be the return, but then obviously
because Tom Cruise infiltrates this meeting, and basically knocks out Kittredge again. I don't think the relationships are very clear here.
No, he has a couple of masks, didn't he? He has the mask of that guy, who plays when he infiltrates the meeting, and then has a Kittredge mask. So I think it's hilarious.
There's definitely a weakness here. There's a weakness in that they've trailed too heavily what this key is too early, and they've left it completely unclear on the Kittredge Ethan Hunt relationship at this point.
They kind of they're basically sort of butting heads, aren't they?
Yeah, constantly. They are. So he's got half the key. Now they believe the second half is going to be. Mm. This is all to do with the White Witch, I think. This is all to do with the fact that they're going to travel via Abu Dhabi International Airport. White Widow, did I say White Witch? I think I was thinking of Scarlet Witch and got the two.
I was
going to
say Scarlet, yeah, that's completely different.
Yeah, alright then. So they've got to go. We're already going to Abu Dhabi at this point, aren't we?
Yeah.
And I still don't know. Have we had the titles at this point? I think the title's after he knocks out Kittredge, isn't it?
Yes. Okay. What do we think of the titles?
Tried not to look at them. I noticed the ever since 4, and I'm not consistent on this, I think 4 they gave too much away, because they spend most of that film trying to stop a missile being launched, and then it shows you it being launched in the film, and you think, so for 2/3 of the film it's like, well, we know you're not going to stop this. And I thought that was a mistake, and since then I've always worried they show too much. It's of a piece. They've certainly standardised the sort of font choices now and how the title comes up.
Yeah.
The only observation I'd have is if Joe Kramer's score was kind of lush because it was the Bond film of this series, last time out, Lorne Balfe's was very sparse and percussive.
Yeah, there isn't very much to it, is there? There's,
but this
you,
time...
Kind of, you kind of get the Mission Impossible like drum corps.
Don't that's, you think it's more foreboding this time? The score
is,
just
yeah,
generally.
It's more kind of like and kind of quite sort of quite heavy. Especially like during, I noticed it during the scene in the sandstorm. I mean, you kind of get all that, you get the noise of like the wind and everything going by, and obviously the guns and you know the gunfight and everything.
Yes.
And then you kind of hear like this kind of really low kind of bassy kind of underscoring as well, and it's like there's too much noise.
I think so. I don't think it's letting the actual melody of the theme breathe enough.
No, we really sort of hear
it's
it again
weakest,
in title sequence
it's the
and again
weakest
at the end.
Since, I mean, I don't remember them all now. I mean, we did them in a short period of time before. But I always remember when we watched Mission Impossible 4, not commenting on the score. The score was perfectly good. I think it was a Giacchino score. But I didn't like the way the opening titles sounded in that film. And I've liked them since, and I'm not sure about them this time. I've still used them on the intro to the show because I've done that on every single one. The worst is still the second one. But I'm not sure about this.
No, that's pretty cool. I do like the songs. I like how they've all kind of, well, largely, have all sort of harked back to like the original show, where it's kind of like, it reminds me of obviously watching a lot of Anderson, like obviously Space 1999. This episode, and they'll show you the clips of what's going to happen, and obviously that all kind of started with the original Mission Impossible show.
I understand that. The only thing I wish they'd continued is. At the end of the pre-title in 4 in Ghost Protocol, he says light the fuse, and they light the fuse and it takes you into the credits, and I wish I almost wish they'd do that every single time. Find a contrivance to light something to take us into the credits.
Yeah, that would be cool. That would be like the gun barrel of the one
yeah
film,
that would be their stylistic tick.
That'd be cool.
I would love that.
Tom, if you're listening, do it please.
Because I know you're a fan listening with the corpse of the Queen and the Force Ghost of Ronnie Corbett. And...
You might just, I don't know, Tom, if you're listening, welcome.
Yeah, Riddick Bowe, if you're with him.
The Queen could be a Force Ghost now, yeah.
No, because she was head of the Church of England. I think she'd see putting Jedi on down as her religion, as sacrilege. So I think, Riddick Bowe, if you're there listening, can you intimidate Tom into this? You're a lot bigger than him. Right, we got this sorted.
I thought the titles was... Obviously, they went for more the digital theme, one of the things that I picked up on.
Yes.
Broadly speaking, I was kind of all right, but it did the thing like Rogue Nation did, where it showed you enough about ruining anything.
They are looking more consistent now as well.
But
they've got their house style.
The thing that made me go like, oh no, was when it kind of did like a recap. It kind of like it kind of as if it was tailing off, and it's sort of like, and we're gonna go again because we've got a bit more to do. Do you know what I mean? I was just a bit, oh no, why have we done that? But,
So it's funny. 4 is one of my least favourite pieces of music on these credits, but I liked the style of it, but I didn't like the spoiler. I liked the dissolve into it, if you like, a bit like a bit like you've had in Bond films in recent years, where a piece of action, at least back, probably before, but certainly at least back to The World Is Not Enough, where he drops off the Millennium Dome, lands in the credit sequence. We've had variations on it before that, but since then it's always been a lot more of a stylized thing, and I liked that, but it's fine, it's okay. But now we're in Abu Dhabi, and I think, thinking about it, Chris's complaint, I don't want to characterize it as a complaint because he can speak for himself, this is not a particularly well balanced team, is it? You said this earlier in the show, Cruz,
basically Cruz, and you got like Luther, who, I mean, I know Tom Cruise is about 60, but, you know.
But, yeah, he's still action man. Yeah. And you've got Luther, who basically insists on sitting down in most scenes.
Because, you know, because he looks like he's going to have a heart attack if he runs more
than
10
I think the problem is, they said this about Ving Rhames in the last film, because he had to kneel towards the end of that film and while he was talking to Michelle Monaghan and sort of trying to do whatever it was he was trying to do. And Macquarie said that wasn't easy for him because his knees are pretty shot.
Yeah, I'll say it must be kind of like health-based reasons.
And towards the end of the film, when we're going to have non-stop action, he's conveniently got something else to go off and do. And again, I'm overthinking this now because of the way we know Macquarie is. Is it like they shot that first and like he wasn't in it, and then later they decide we've got a bigger role for Luther, we now have to have, you know what I mean, it's like how did this come about, or is it simply he's just got no role in that end of the film?
It's a shame that he kind of almost vanishes a little bit. Obviously we see Benji up to a point until they get on the train, and then the both of them just seem to, and that's it, and obviously we see them everybody at the end.
I missed that from the first film. Do you know how I said, and it was because I did a bit of research on the Mission Impossible TV series, which I saw when they showed it on BBC Two in the early 90s or whatever, but I'd not seen it in years. And I remember like familiarising myself with the format, and then I went and watched the first film. And until they're all betrayed and killed, the first 28 minutes or whatever it was I said at the time is a Mission Impossible episode, just on the big screen. And we're missing that now in the so many of these films. You think back to 3, where he explains how the fulcrum's going to work. In the first film, they're all infiltrating that building and they've all got a different task to do. Act 3 of this film is just two of them and Tom Cruise is winging it anyway. And we do get a little bit of a sort of flash forward to what it could look like. But it's a little bit played down in this film, which makes me think they might have been winging it a bit. But let's talk about Abu Dhabi Airport then. What do we think of all this? This is where we're introduced to the Grace character.
Yeah, it's a fun sequence. So you got Ethan Hunt's now like a wanted man. So you got his own agency after him. So you have
they're called the Community, and it's what's the actor called? Broke his nose in Fast 4 or 5, one of the two. It is Shea Whigham.
Yeah.
Shea Whigham, and I love the fact that his sidekick, his sidekick, is called Greg Tarzan Davis.
That's amazing that he's Tarzan.
Is that his middle name, or is it a double-barrelled in, like, Mum's Tarzan?
Tarzan Davis.
You know, his dad's surname was Tarzan, and his mum was... What is he, you know, this kid's born and you're like, Tarzan.
His name is Tarzan, that's amazing.
Yeah, so they're chasing him, but they're basically hunting Ethan on behalf of the Community, which is basically this sort of joint intelligence community, effectively, for America. I don't want to nitpick this film to death because I really like it, but I never felt any great peril from them. I never thought he'd struggle getting away from them particularly at any point.
It's probably just his way to show that, you know, what kind of like what the entity can do, and how Benji and Ving Rhames, Benji and Luther can fight back against it. And there's probably a chance to show a bit of like comedy and camaraderie between them as well, because they kind of try and have a bit of one-upmanship against who can code better.
I think it's
a little bit contrived.
I think at this point is they're just like another obstacle.
Yeah.
So like,
So I think there's that. As there's also that element of like having a bit of fun, you know, with them sort of playing around with the camera, like kind of doing what AI could do, which is kind of make them think that, oh, Ethan Hunt's walking there. That's
yeah, they're putting Ethan's face on other people randomly.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a cool sequence. So yeah, there's a bit of a sort of coding off. And there's also the setting of what we appear is a bomb.
Mm. Yeah, dropped off by Gabriel.
And at the same time, Grace is pickpocketed this key. So he's following it with this augmented sort of technology on his face. And eventually he ends up chasing her. And it's quite a complex scene, actually. It sort of scans the whole... It reminded me of what you said about the sixth film, and I think I probably said it too, that Macquarie sort of looks at the layout of the place and then designs the scene around the layout, rather than write a sequence and then try and fit it to some architecture.
Yeah.
Because they really do use all areas of this airport that they can.
Yeah, because obviously they make good use out of it because they had full access, apparently. So
Paris Pom Klimentyev, I don't know how you pronounce her name, the buyer is basically dead, so they now need to outrun the community and defuse this bomb, which is a series of riddles, really. All
questions. I thought that was a bit kind of underwhelming, because obviously it's our kind of main introduction to Gabriel, a little bit almost. Yeah. He's basically kind of like, he's essentially a ghost.
It's not real. And I'm not quite sure.
No,
I don't know if that's meant to distract them so he can get the key or not get the key or whatever. I think.
No, I thought it was quite obviously tense because it's a race against time, basically. It's a ticking clock. But I kind of felt like the payoff was a little bit like, oh, when he was like, oh, it was empty. Yeah. I was like, oh.
I mean, basically, Ethan and Gabriel, I mean, obviously they've got priors, but also Gabriel is the avatar of the entity, effectively. He's there to represent it. So, and he know Tom Cruise is the only one, Ethan Hunt is the only one who's going to destroy it. So
maybe that's why his character kind of wears a lot of like light colours, because he's not really, well, it's, as you say, it's just a vessel, pretty much.
It's more the fact that, again, they're not supposed to know where what this key is to, but Gabriel does, undermines it later when the American head knows. But he's supposed to be it would be stronger if he was the only one that knew. Literally the only one that knew, because he.
That's why he kills him.
Yes, I understand that, but it tells you more than one person knew in the first place. And
yeah,
Paris
knows. Yeah, it's very sneaky.
So it would have been stronger, because Ethan at points can't kill this guy, even when others are still alive. When Luther warns him, "You can't kill this guy," the American guy who also knows is still alive. But we'll come back to that. So where do we go from here?
So we introduced to Grace, who the Hayley Atwell's character, who has been sent to steal. So she's been hired by the entities unknowingly.
Yeah.
To basically sort of steal this key.
Yeah.
And
Gabriel is around almost to sort of protect her path to do this.
Yeah,
because his augmented, his coding has effectively removed his images from all surveillance, but not his reflection. So he catches him in a mirror at one point. Okay.
Yeah, and the whole thing with the bomb was like again a distraction, but a way to gain information, so the entity could learn about. More about the team, I suppose. I mean, I forget what exactly it does find out.
I suppose it's getting plenty of samples of their voice and how they work together and so on. Because this will come up later when Cruz is being sort of navigated around Paris. Grace gets away from him, and so she's basically heading to Rome now. Now, this is... He effectively follows. I don't know if he's able to follow on the first flight, but he gets there. And I think the whole Rome thing was part of the whole shooting around COVID sort of thing, because they couldn't get into Venice. So we have sequences there first. And so the authority. He's wanted, and Paris wants her, wants him and her, so they're being pursued. And this is where I start getting confused. Is this a plot hole? He's been hired to get the key. Is the point that Paris will now kill her and just take the key back? Is that the point? Because they're being chased.
So who's been hired?
Right, so you said Grace was hired effectively by the entity. Gabriel and Paris represent the entity. If that's the case, they would either be protecting Grace, or now she's got what they want, they'll just kill her. And they need to kill Ethan anyway, because he's a threat to them.
I thought she was hired by White Widow character, but maybe not.
Well, that's what I thought, but I'm going with what Chris said. I assumed the White Widow did it.
Beck has seen this 3 times, which is more than me. So
I thought it was the White Widow. Chris said it with confidence. I was like, yeah, fair enough, because I wasn't sure.
Well, because there's that scene in the bar, don't they? And she's like, oh, no, you hired me.
I forgot about that. Yes.
So, okay. So it is her.
I mean, she is the broker, so she needs the two halves. It would make more sense. Mm. Either way, it would make sense for Gabriel and his team to kill her anyway, because she's got what they want, even if she's done it for them. Okay, so we've then got this chase across London. Rome, sorry. A bit of a Freudian slip, because we've had London chases in the past. They're looking for an IMF safeguard. They're looking for the 2CV. They nearly find it. The car they find is For Your Eyes Only. Now, there's a lot of Bond callbacks.
It is very much For Your Eyes Only, isn't it?
This feels, even down to the colour, this feels deliberate. This does feel deliberate, because it's
got to be, hasn't it? It really has got to be. Obviously, you know, when in Italy, it's got to be the Fiat as well. And it's got to be a Cinquecento. It's got to be a Fiat 500.
Yeah.
It's sort of like they've earned their way up, because it was initially like someone else's... It was originally a police car. Then it was like what's the community's car?
Yeah, yeah.
Who all of them get killed by Paris.
Yeah.
Except for like the main two.
Yeah.
So it's just be like the main two.
Oh, it is carnage. It reminded me of watching like Terminator 3 or something. The car chase at the start of that, where just
it was crazy.
But the thing to note here was there was just a lot more comedy in it. If you think back to the big chases in the last two films, they've been relatively tense.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't fall down... I mean, Spectre looks even worse, doesn't it? Because they had a car chase in Rome, but it was relaxed as fuck.
That was quite a very poor car chase for the Bond film.
This still has tension, but like when the car rolls and they land in the opposite seat to each other and stuff like that and just look confused...
and then how the bracelets sort of come off and they're like, wait, what? And it's just like, how did this happen?
I think it's pretty well done, though.
I think, random fun fact as well, I can't remember the exact wording, but on the if you stay right to the end of the credits... There was credits basically saying that the Spanish Steps didn't appear in this film. Obviously, it was filmed on the soundstage to try and protect, you know, that they wouldn't let them trash the Spanish Steps for sure. If you're wondering, is there an untitled sequence at the end of the film?
The bit we've missed before this, the bit we've just missed is she was immediately arrested when she got to Rome. So, and Cruz poses as her lawyer. And manages to sort of get himself sort of cuffed to her. And eventually this scene ends with him being cuffed to the steering wheel of the car as a train's approaching, and she leaves him to it. So she escapes him here.
Mm.
And, he gets back up onto the street, and, like, Luther and Benji finds him, and they've got Ilsa with him. And we get a load of exposition about the entity. We get some exposition about Gabriel having killed this woman close to him. Doesn't really matter who she was, and it has no emotional stakes.
Looks a lot like Hayley Atwell, I thought at the time, because you don't really see her.
Do you know who she reminded me of? She was like a cross between George Clooney's real-life wife. If you ever look up George Clooney's real-life wife.
She's a high-flying lawyer.
Yeah, she is. And the sacrificial lamb early in Casino Royale.
Oh.
She's got a much more angular face than Hayley Atwell. She's also thinner in the face and a little bit darker skinned, a bit more Mediterranean.
Mm.
Wouldn't be surprised if she was Spanish or something like that. So now they're going to go to a party in Venice that they know Gabriel will attend. And this is where we meet up with the White Widow again.
I think that's a pretty cool sequence, though. I mean, it's a bit of a trope. It kind of did remind me a little bit of John Wick 4.
I thought of John Wick 2 as well, because that was set in Italy.
Yeah, John Wick, definitely. Also in... When they go to Vienna in previous Mission Impossible films, it's that kind of trope, isn't it, of these sort of films? I mean, it still looks very stylish.
The big party. We had it in the last film where he was posing as John Locke and all that as well.
That was it, yeah.
And the John Locke thing comes back. It's one of the very few things in this film that doesn't stand alone, but the film waves its hand over it, like, don't worry, viewer, she thinks I'm called John Locke.
Yeah.
You can just about get away with seeing this film, because the emotional stakes, apart from Ilsa, the emotional stakes are all about a woman that everybody who's not seen any of the films, seen all of the films, won't know anything about anyway. And Ilsa, we get the impression they're close. We've never even seen them kiss. I mean, we're not even sure if they're a relationship. They're not really working together when the film opens. So you can get away with this, but the John Locke thing does make a comeback.
It implies that there is some romance, but we don't actually see it.
It's a bit of a hug on the rooftop, which he will return to after she passes away later. So he's there and hugs her, and then he's there later on his own mourning her for the 5 or 6 seconds before he gets back into action. I think it's... We'll get to the death in a minute. These films can pull all sorts of bait and switches, but we'll talk about that in a bit. We're going to assume for now she's permanently dead, and I'll have things to say about it when we get there. We find out that the White Widow, Alana Mitsopoulos, I don't even know if we got her name last time, she's got the other half of the key. And she did, yeah, we find out here she hired Grace to find the other half. And Gabriel's there talking about the entity and why the key needs to be brought to it. And it's got this sort of Avengers Infinity War, Doctor Strange, I can see every conceivable outcome.
Yeah, it's a little bit like that. It's quite busy, the scene as well. There's kind of too many characters, please eliminate one. And it's kind of like a fight scene that isn't really a fight scene.
Well, I do enjoy...
And Tom Cruise runs like the cracker, like, you know, like the clappers.
I do enjoy the entity's visualisation of, like, the Eye of Sauron.
Yeah, or the Epidemic virus from Red Dwarf 7. But yeah, one of the two. It's got some of that. There's a little bit of the Howl eye. It always seems to have a sort of centre to it, doesn't it? Like a core. Mm. Even if that core is like an absence, it's all sort of concentric. But he sort of tells Ethan that it's Ilsa or Grace, and asks him to choose. And I'm thinking, Ilsa, obviously. I know that sounds daft, but you've got someone who's first seen in the entire... Her first scene in Mission Impossible was saving Ethan's life. There's clearly an affection there. She's worked with him. The audience has an attachment against a pickpocket who left him to get hit by a train, potentially. Like, hours earlier. This is an idiotic choice, I'm sorry.
This is one of the things that... I get it in principle.
The principle would be Grace is more vulnerable than Ilsa.
Yeah, I the principle is just Ethan Hunt's ability, sort of like, I can't allow any of them to die regardless, no matter where, you know, what my genuine opinion of, you know, I cannot let anyone die. Like, you will see that as a failure no matter what.
Grace, you make the point, you think that the woman who died 30 years before looks a bit like Grace, and whilst I sort of subtly disagreed, they're the same colour palette. It might be a bit of a flashback thing of I can't watch that happen again.
You can find her on IMDb. I've had a look, because at first I wasn't too sure, because the scenes we're talking about are very short. They're very colour distorted as well, like almost like black and white. So you don't really get a good look at at first. I thought, does that look any that well? So at first I thought,
yeah, I was like,
is it going to be revealed that, like, oh, that was her mum, and there's a bit of an attachment there? Do you know what I mean? There's a bit.
Could have been. I mean, the White Widow is the daughter of Max, so you never know. This world does keep getting smaller.
But it isn't. I know that. But one of the things that I did have sort of trouble. It's like, yeah, but you did leave him to die. So are you that kind of? There's a little bit of.
I'm not convinced it completely works, and again, I do have a problem with this J.J. Abrams idea of go really fast and don't let anyone think. But I think actually here it just about gets away with it, that because it doesn't fall apart when you think about it, it just leads you to question the wisdom of it, that's all.
I do think when it does happen, Hayley Atwell character, it does there's no ambiguity left after that. It's just, she's like, oh my god, I feel awful, I'm at my depth, that Tom Cruise wanting to works.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So when he says, like, I can't promise I can protect you, but I can promise
you. Yeah, I mean, I think Benji says, yes, we can. Can you promise you protect me? He says, yes, and he says, no, none of us can. But I promise you my life will always mean more than yours.
Which I think
I said in one of my reviews that's how you do emotional stakes without depressing us, because it's a beat, and it's a beat that if you think about it could make you a bit depressed, that this far into your life are you not valuing your own life? And it's like, no, he's just got this kind of Superman complex that he wants to protect everybody. That's why Julia ended up having to sort of leave him to it, and it's not miserable, it's just that he has seen people die. There's enough there to emotionally involve you without depressing you. And whilst I liked Craig's run as Bond, although much more the early part of it, with that and Indiana Jones, certainly in the last few years, I think leave the pain and introspection to Batman. It suits that character.
Yeah, we don't want to get in the ball.
I don't mind it, but I don't want it in every sort of globe-trotting, this is meant to be fun caper. I mean, imagine if Ocean's 11, they were all fucking depressed about erectile dysfunction or something. It's like, it's not appropriate. Get on with it. Yeah. But
so it's basically what you're saying, Dave, is like sort of the concept of introducing fun to a big blockbuster.
I'm saying it doesn't stop you having emotional stakes. He was, you know, he still does lose it, but he probably doesn't mourn her quite enough, if anything. But, you know, it's like, if you think back to even some of the more throwaway Bond films, and I don't mean to insult it, but The World Is Not Enough, that film only half works. But you do feel that, like, he's hurt by Elektra's betrayal. You can still have that. Bond was hurt by Vesper's betrayal and death, but I still thought the film was balanced, if at the grittier end of Bond. But by the time he's like, is there any point to me? And my life's been terrible because I lost Madeline and all that. And it's like, I'm not meant to feel sorry for you. Not all the time. I'm meant to sympathise with your difficulties as you encounter them in life. But you are broadly doing something you enjoy. And I think this film gets it right, more or less. If anything, it underplays it slightly. Because I think you could overstress this sequence as his life's a bit sad, but I don't think it's meant that way. Later, he arguably doesn't mourn Ilsa enough. But at least there's stakes. We care, but we're not depressed about Ethan Hunt's horrible life.
I think, because I think with Fallout, I think last one pointed this out a little. I get the idea that it's just who he is. So the idea that he tried to retire, but he just couldn't, like, switch off. He couldn't, like, he couldn't, like,
Julia,
see, like,
and Julia said
he couldn't see something horrible happen.
Yeah. I mean, and remember,
like, I could have stopped that. You know,
Macquarie
what I mean?
Made the last one as well, and Macquarie had Julia say. I mean, he co-wrote this one, but I think he wrote the last one on his own. There's no such thing as on your own in Mission Impossible, because I'm sure they're all pitching in, and he is having conversations with crews and stuff. But he ostensibly wrote it that she said something like, "I'd be with him, and I'd wonder about all the people out there he wasn't helping and wasn't saving while he was with me." So I think that's consistent, and I'm okay with it, but I still have, and I think it's just because I think Ilsa was that stronger character, and I joked about it earlier in the show, like, it's, oh, I'm more attracted to her. Well, whether that's true or not, Hayley Atwell's a beautiful woman. It's just Ilsa's a very, very strong character to kill in what I think is quite a cheap way. I think it's we faked out once. We get the entity sending Ethan the wrong way because it's infiltrated the computer because it can get in anywhere digital, and it can mimic the voices. So it's randomly saying left, no, right, and it's Benji and like Luther realize they're locked out and just smash the computer. But they have this little sort of alleyway fight. Him and what's she called again? Sorry,
Paris.
Not sure how well that worked, but it was okay. I mean, it was tense because it was like, we know what's coming and he can't get there because it's holding him up. Mm. And it's Ilsa fighting Gabriel. And he gets there late and obviously she's dead. Now, on that, I just want to say, I thought it was cheap. I think it was a cheap way to give us emotional stakes. It was a cheap way to get Hayley Atwell to see, to sort of see sense and behave a bit more sensibly going forward. I suspect she is really dead because Cruz stood over her for a long time with a knife in her heart. Unless that's somebody else in a mask who can magically fight as well as Ilsa, I suspect she's permanently dead.
I think you would probably. I know you can always sort of like.
They can always undo it because of the way they work.
But I think you would betray the audience by doing that. Yeah, do you know what I mean? It'll just be like that. You'd just be like, "Oh, come on, then."
It's a bit like a lot of people talk about Craig. They're determined to see a single continuity in Bond. So you get people saying, "Well, we didn't see his body," and it's like, "I'm sorry, you saw the shot where he was fucking immolated. If he turns up with amnesia in the next film, that isn't like great. They followed the novels. That's no, they betrayed the audience. Whether that was the right decision or not, as filmmakers, that's the decision they made. Don't undo it now."
Mm.
And I think the same's true as Ilsa. And there's no reason that if it's not her that's died, somebody else has, and that just betrays the whole emotional stakes of this whole series.
Yeah.
But
you know, but the way you got to look at these things, sometimes it just maybe. She didn't want to do anymore, so that's why. Mm. So that's why Rebecca Ferguson, maybe she's like, yeah, I don't really want to do anymore. Thanks.
It could be that she's got some TV show on Amazon, hasn't she? And she's got a young family. She was pregnant during Fallout, so that suggests she's got like a 6-year-old now or something, or you know whatever. Probably a 4-year-old when this was shot. So you know, if it's her decision, fine. I do think it's a shame. I'd have almost been tempted to Jeremy Renner her instead. That she's out there somewhere doing rogue things, but
yeah, she's off doing something else. Yeah,
that would have been fine. But anyway, so death. They are all sort of feeling remorse. That brings sort of Grace into things, and it's like we all had to make a choice, which is a complete retcon of what the IMF is, but that's okay. Because they've been going rogue for so many years now, and he gets his mission when he's on his own. We haven't had a room sort of team briefing since probably the first, well, maybe the third one. Certainly the first had it. It's always been a handful of them now. So I'm kind of all right with it. And Luther disappears. He basically says to... I need to go away now. I need to leave now because you've already shot the last third of the film and I'm not in it, probably. And also, I can't really do much more than sit down. So he disappears off, and I think it's to do with see if he can find any traces of the entity on that hard drive. And again, it gives them an out to do something in the next film that Luther's found this idea. What if? They're spitballing constantly. This is almost like improvised filmmaking. It's incredible how they do it. But his final thing is to tell Ethan, don't kill Gabriel, because he's the only one that knows what the entity needs that key for. So if you kill him, we'll never know what it's for. The entity goes unchecked. Gabriel will try to kill you because you're the only threat to absolutely wiping out the entity, which is, we're not quite sure what the relationship here is, but Gabriel clearly needs the entity in existence.
Yeah. I'm kind of hoping it will all be revealed next time, because this is getting dragged and dragged and dragged. This is like, get on with it.
Yeah, I do like that little sort of detail with the character. So with Gabriel, sort of when Ilsa turns up after, you know, while he's having a fight with Grace, and you know, he does say, "Oh God, it's you," because he knows that if I kill you, that I prefer that because I know it'll piss Ethan off even more.
And yeah, I know that epic fight. Yeah. And then when she turns up, because I was hoping it would be you, and it's like, oh my God.
And you, as I say, the first thing we ever saw her do is save Ethan's life. And if you think about less about story and more about the mechanics of what the filmmakers are trying to tell us, it wasn't an accident they introduced her that way. She's meant to be incredibly formidable. Ethan doesn't need saving by many people. That's almost
the fight anyway. I think it's quite brutal. We kind of said a little bit earlier on, you kind of got the fight in the alleyway.
Yeah, no, we keep cutting between the two, and the tension all comes from the fact that it's a race against the clock. I think I know instantly Ilsa's dying. Ethan's being held up too much. The Gabriel can't be defeated at this point. So I think it was pretty clear to me that this
will probably just dissolve into a dew at the end. It'll just vanish like a ghost.
Yeah.
And it'll be like, oh, fine.
You know, like I said at the beginning of the show, it's like, the plan could have gone completely wrong. It'd be, what if Elsa won the fight? I mean, she is capable of it.
Yeah, and he had these sort of little stiletto blades on him, not like big swords like she had. She certainly had a reach advantage, put it that way. But it was quite well done. And again,
but like how many? Obviously, he's an assassin.
Yeah.
But like how many? You know, as good job he probably. Well, he must have snuck through that airport. Because like how many blades has he got on him? Like in that bar scene, he's got like two great big knives, and then and
you don't know what he had at the airport.
He pulls out all these knives from everywhere. It's like, does he?
Well, tinkle?
Does he sound like a joke shop? You know?
The entity is covering his tracks for him. If he goes through like a metal scanner, what's to stop the entity stopping it making any noise? If it's
that's true, he'll probably press a button somewhere.
We already saw it was erasing his face.
Like the in the airport, we put the bag on.
Yeah.
The entity covered the fact that it was like, well, a fake bomb, but it knew to reveal it like enough to
take Benji to it.
To Benji and Luther to go like, oh shit, we need to sort this out. Do you know what I mean?
And you say he's an assassin. That sounds obvious, but we don't actually know what he is yet. He had something to do with. Was he a Philip Seymour Hoffman type, or was he an Emilio Estevez type gone bad?
Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know. Was he in the IMF?
He's literally just kind of like, he's a sort of vessel. He's just a messenger.
It would make sense if he was in the IMF, because then you've basically got the 006 Alec Trevelyan syndrome, that like he's Bond gone bad. He's Ethan gone bad. Same skill set.
I wonder same if he is training. He could be Ethan gone
he's
rogue.
He's Silver all over again. It's
oh
like,
God. It only is literally Silver.
We're not so different, you and I.
Yeah.
I prefer
Skyfall to GoldenEye as well. I should have used that example. Yeah. Okay. So we're almost done with the plot here. The only salient plot point left is all the powers of the world are trying to get to the White Widow to get this key, and she's like a broker for it. And the more quote-unquote honest brokers will bid for it. There are powers in the world that would probably fight for it, but so Kittredge is going to meet her on this train and basically get it. Unfortunately, I think Gabriel's got the key at this point. I do lose track of that, but anyway. So
it's like that scene at the beginning of Temple of Doom, isn't it, where they're trying to find the antidote and it gets kicked all over the dance floor.
It is very like that, actually.
And that's kind of what I know. That's very shorthand and not really, but that's kind of what it reminded me of there. I'm sure there's a corresponding Bond scene.
Probably. I definitely thought, but we'd see one of the few flash forwards, and I liked that. I mean, I liked it in Fallout, where you think Ethan's going to shoot somebody dressed as like a cop or security, and it's like, oh, it's just a flash forward. Because you occasionally, because there's years between these films, you forget the films do that occasionally. Yeah. Of course, we get a flash forward to them getting on the train as the White Widow and associate. And the White Widow has brown eyes, which Vanessa Kirby does not. They don't change the eyes in this. The one thing is, their voices are quite similar when you close your eyes. I wasn't sure until she took the mask off that she had the throat thing on to disguise her voice. I couldn't tell if that was Hayley Atwell or Vanessa Kirby's voice, but it was Vanessa Kirby's. But the thing sort of breaks before it's done her mask, but it hasn't done his. So he's now got to find another way onto the train because he can't walk on with her. She's got to get on, find a way to replace the White Widow, and do all the negotiations.
I mean, it did sound convoluted. It's like, what, so you can't just like jump on and just be a bit sneaky?
Yeah, I don't think it's the greatest plan I've ever seen. It's taken with the action. What it's lacking is that your job is to do this, and while you're doing that, I'm doing this, and while you're doing it, I'm doing that. I'm not. I lose track of Benji in this. Has Benji got anything to do? I can't remember.
To give instructions to.
Sort of, but you know, to get him on there, and then you've got. I can't remember if she's supposed to sell the key or keep the key or what. I forget all that. But anyway, the bottom line is Ethan has to find a way onto this train. Gabriel gets there first and sort of speeds it up so Cruz misses it. That is a slight plot mistake, because the reason you have to keep filling it with coal is to keep it powered. It would have slowly slowed down after that. And that leads to the big stunt. She's already on there as the White Widow. She knocks out the original one. Kittredge is killed by... Not Kittredge, sorry. Carrie Elwes, I've forgotten his character name, is killed by Gabriel because he's the only other person who knows what that key's for. How he knows, I don't really remember. I think it's because they designed it in the first place and sent it onto the Sevastopol, wasn't it?
Probably for plot reasons.
Yeah, so they know it's on there. If you find that craft, that's where it is. And they've got a fair idea, but it took some months to find the bodies and they could have drifted. But if they can find where that thing sunk, they know what it is, and it's the source code to control it. Ethan is off the view, it's not controllable. So she's already on, she's already in a position to negotiate, which I think is tense as hell. And Vanessa Kirby does an incredible job pretending to be Hayley Atwell, pretending to be her. I think that's extraordinary, because I never doubt it for a moment. And Ethan's got to like do some big jump to get on this thing. What do we think of the jump?
Becca, what do you think? You've seen
it. Oh my gosh. I've seen it three goddamn times. I'm kind of glad I did see it three times, but none of those times have been in IMAX, unfortunately. But otherwise, I would have forgotten most of this film. So this is the biggest stunt ever, perhaps alongside Burj Khalifa, to be committed to Mission Impossible film. I'm not like scared of heights. I mean, it was a little high, you know, quite high up.
Most people are a bit
nervous.
Unsettled, yeah.
I wouldn't say I was like terrified of heights, sort of thing. I mean, it's quite scary, but I think going to see this at the cinema, all the audiences that I've seen it with, we all kind of you could, you know, a sharp intake of breath, and we all kind of recalled a little bit in our seats. We were like, eek. So I can only imagine seeing it on IMAX.
I did see it in IMAX, and it just didn't do that for me.
What? Oh my god, that's crazy. No, that's fine. That was just my reaction for sure. But yeah, each time there was a little bit like, and you could hear, you know, hear the audience kind of have that same sort of reaction as well. But as I say, it wasn't like it hasn't been packed the times I've seen it, but it kind of been quite sort of, you know, spaced out at odd times of the day. But yeah, I did kind of, you know, other people, including myself, kind of made that, you know, kind of reaction. So.
I've got no critique of it. It's how it takes you, but I've just it didn't. I mean, it's an impressive stunt, well done, and I don't want to get blasé about it. This guy,
no, I think it's also
life.
It's quite heavily trailed as well. Yeah. Like that's the kind of big stunt. I mean, that and the Orient Express falling off a cliff.
I think it was that he just fell away, and it like that looked so perfect. It could almost be fake, if you know what I mean. Even though we know it's him, so it isn't.
He kind of expected like,
and then it kind of,
to kick in.
And then
know,
he opens the sort of thing, and then that's it. We almost forget about it till he crashes into the window later, just as Hayley was about to be killed. I thought it was okay. I don't want to be blasé about the stunts. He's risking our lives his life to entertain us. But I've enjoyed some of the set pieces more in the last couple of films. That's all. Well, the last three films, really.
The one in Dubai in 4.
That still stands out to me. That's still the one.
Because you look at it and think, fuck me, that's high.
Yeah. And we know he has guide ropes on it, but you'd still shit yourself.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it was okay. So he gets onto the train. What do we want to say from here? A lot of fighting on the top of a train. I don't want to...
AI on the Orient Express.
I think his entrance on the train was... I think they played that right.
Yeah.
Because... it is ridiculous. It is a bit unrealistic.
He's a bit out of control, and that's actually appropriate.
It's a bit like, oh, that's a bit lucky, but then there's a little bit of like, see, I told you I'd be here.
And the action from there, I don't really know what I want to say about it other than it's a mixture of the, wow, that's impressive, and I've seen this before, in that all the train top sequences have got so rope that ever back to Spider-Man 2. And from there on, you had it in The Wolverine, you had it in Skyfall, you had it in the first Mission Impossible, actually, and so on. And you've had so many of them now. We had them in Indy a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I think it's become, it's another trope, isn't it?
Do it impressively, it's one of the few things where I could see they digitally replaced the background.
Perhaps a trend that Mission Impossible started, perhaps, and you know other films have carried it on? I don't know.
It seems to be like a
trope of certainly this year's blockbusters.
Bond started it in recent times, in that like I've seen far more of them since Skyfall than I did before.
Yeah.
But I mean, with him having the knives, he seemed more sure of his sort of grip and footing than Ethan. I've got very little to say about it. I thought it was impressive. I thought it was impressive what they were doing. I thought the tension of it was dramatic. But of course, when the train eventually crashes, it's too close to Uncharted. It's Uncharted 2 sequence.
It is a little bit like that. But I mean, it's the Orient Express, isn't it? It's kind of like the all-time kind of luxury train. Yeah. And considering they basically, you know, very little of it is CGI. They recreated down to the fine detail. They, you know, recreated, I think they shot it in Norway and somewhere in England, and they recreated the train perfectly due to, you know, the detailed type of velvet they used as well. But yeah, it was shot very well. It's literally, this is the point where I was literally on the edge of my seat, and it's quite interesting to see like how Ethan is basically, as you said earlier in the show, he's basically winging it, literally flying by the seat of his pants. And it's quite interesting as well to have someone like Hayley Atwell. She is, you know, she's a thief at the end of the day. And she's kind of weighing over her head, but she's kind of, you know, she's
the one plus scared to it being her rather than Ilsa. Yeah. Is the
that's
sense
it, exactly.
There's the it's momentary
contrast.
Now, we've seen films, it's very unlikely she's going to steal the money. It's possible because there is a part two. She could do a double cross to leave a cliffhanger. So it was possible, but it was unlikely. But also, if Ilsa was there, or Paula Patton's character, or somebody like that, there wouldn't be the same sense of fear. So it does suit this act.
No, there wouldn't be that kind of tension there at all, because you kind of got like average person.
And Gabriel get, and of course she's a pickpocket, so Gabriel gets away, but he gets away without the key.
No, definitely. But yeah, I think the sequence is really well done. But I just kind of think it's a health and safety nightmare because, like, everything's kind of going off the cliff. Like, you know, gas comes loose. There's a pipe going everywhere. There's like hot water everywhere, boiling water everywhere, liquid on the floor, cans, bottles, food, hot food, everything. You know, there's fire, and it's just like, and she, you know, Hayley Atwell ends up.
That was impressive because
she ends up quite on fire.
I bet the fire was real as well, because we just know what this crew do. I mean, they're not gonna like kill people for the sake of realism if you can fake some of it with. For example, on the top of the train, they're not on a real train at that speed because the background has been replaced, probably to speed it up. You can see that.
No, you can see what they went back and shot it many times, like on a soundstage, and you know, he did repeat it many times to try and get it right as well. But I kind of think that the CGI in this scene as well, I think it was done quite well. I mean, there's probably maybe a couple of scenes where it does look quite
on top of
the
train
side.
It doesn't look right to me.
I was quite impressed actually. I think because the sort of different, obviously seeing it at different cinemas, you're going to get sort of like different levels of quality.
To be fair, he may be doing it on the top of a train, and he may do these things for real. But even if he's doing it for real, he's still basically playing the part of a stuntman, and there's still cheats and things to keep them safe, but still do it real.
Definitely, of course.
So he doesn't literally throw himself through fire and stand up on a train going
at
100 miles an hour.
You know, he's sensible, isn't he? Even though he's Tom Cruise, and you know, he's going to throw himself 110% into the role.
He does sell it, he's going to kill him. He does sell it, he's going to kill him. Just before all that, when Jasper and Dagus stop him, they do sell it, and then he says, we can't stop this train, we now need your help. So they're now back on side, and we just get that whole sequence, and it's really well done. It's just, it's difficult not to do anything that hasn't been done before. Now, what I heard was
it's a bit of a well-worn trope, isn't it? I mean, I do sort of think, you know, it does call back to previous previous escapades as well.
But do you know what it is? I know exactly what it is. I heard today on another podcast. I've tried to avoid too much of that because I don't want my own opinion polluted by anyone else's. But do you remember how for Fallout, Tom Cruise was asked, what is it you want to do that you haven't done before? And he said, helicopters.
Yeah.
Apparently, Tom Cruise, in the same conversation, reversed the question and said, what about you? And he said, I want to crash a train.
Oh,
so this is something Macquarie wanted to do.
Yeah, it's obviously kind of, you can kind of tell he sort of had a checkbox and say, right, I want to do this. Mm. And it's just like, you can see him going through that list and, you know, checking each one off. And you just think, oh, yeah. You know, but by this point, obviously, Bond's been going for 60 years. Mission Impossible's been going for nearly 30 years. Bourne's been going for many years as well, and it's kind of like what more can you do for, you know, for a franchise that is kind of known for, it's now known for its kind of like big outrageous stunts than it is tightly plotted drama and espionage and things like that.
The one carriage at a time works. I don't remember that quite being the same in Uncharted 2.
That's kind of like the only new thing, but and plus it's the Orient Express, so it's very very glamorous. So I think it's kind of it's a new twist on how. And how we've seen that represented on screen. I think that's quite interesting for it to be used in that way. So lovely Gabriel. Scenery, lovely scenery as well. But it's kind of like, it's just, you know, it's kind of a bit old hash, basically. But so, as I say, I think it's executed very well. I would say probably, like, if anywhere, not that I felt this film's runtime sag at any sort of any point, but, like, if it is, this is kind
I
of
did
where
a bit,
it
but I can't remember where. I think it was a little bit after Ilsa died, probably.
That's it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, largely the CGI is done quite well. Perhaps when in the tunnel, it's perhaps a little bit hazy, like when Gabriel's trying to, like, literally trying to hoik himself up. You know,
when they were stood up on the top of the train, there was a few times where him and Gabriel were face to face. Now, first off,
that's pretty cool. Though.
I think there's two points to make on it. Firstly, I don't think it looks as good as Skyfall, and I'll tell you what. I've just to finish why I'm saying that. But defend the film at the same time. Bond fighting Patrice looked more like they were really on top of a train than him fighting Gabriel in those scenes. But it was mainly when he was face to face to Gabriel. And I'm thinking it may well be Tom Cruise might have one of these wishes to do everything real, but it doesn't mean Isai Morales does. So it may, because it looked real when Cruise was up there and Morales was not in shot. I think
there's a little bit, and there's a scene where it cuts to literally, it's a very tight close up where he really wants to kill him, but he knows he mustn't.
Yeah.
And there's, you can see there's ever so slightly like a bit of a blur, like a bit where on the outline.
Exactly.
I mean that, and then the scene along the Spanish Steps.
But he jumps off just before
escaping the vehicle, and you just think, oh, you can kind of see there's a screen, and you just think, oh.
But the agents stop him killing Gabriel, but before he can do anything else, Gabriel's timing everything perfectly by his watch. Reminded me, you haven't seen him yet, Becca, but it reminds me of the Equalizer films. He does that a lot. He times like 60 seconds to do whatever. He jumps off, lands perfectly in it. That's something only like computer intelligence could do.
It tells him, it's like,
exactly. But
he's like, come on, I gotta do this now.
If you were wrong by a tenth of a second, you'd miss and break your back.
Yeah,
so it has to be perfect. And also, you've got to respond. It's got to know human reaction times to when it hits that. But anyway, I'll give it that pass. But he's killed Paris because the entity dictates that Paris will betray him. But before, and he does, but because she kills him, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Just before she passes out, I don't know if she dies. I thought so. She says the Sebastopol to them. So they now know what we knew 2 hours ago.
So,
and that's it.
Gabriel's failed completely because not only does not have the key, but also he's not. Ethan now knows
where
what
it
he
is.
Knows.
And Kittredge is just addressing Ethan as the next mission is to find this Sebastopol. Good
Your
luck.
Mission. Did you choose to accept it as to watch part two of this film?
And that's it. Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning Part One. Done.
--.
I think as I talk through it, just some final thoughts from me. As I talk through it, I'm identifying more flaws, but I was sort of semi-aware of them as I was watching it. I was saying there's things in this that I don't think will stand up as well as, say, Fallout did. There was a couple of pacing things. It felt disjointed in places. There are a couple of ropey effects, which I haven't seen in a Mission Impossible film for like three or four entries now. There are the Ethan background is contrived, although Tom Cruise sells it. I still think, although he never disappears into a role, he sells you on a role, he sells you on grief, he does sell you on emotional stakes, but they keep it light enough with the masks and the jokes to keep, but they don't make it goofy. You know, there's just the odd joke here. They land in the wrong side of the car to each other. That's funny. Him getting out of the car and he's still attached to the steering wheel because he didn't have enough time. That's funny. But it's not silly. I think the film is perfect for what they're trying to do. But I think we won't know till we see part two. But I think they've overthought in what order they do things, because that submarine sequence could have gone anywhere in the film. It could have gone as a flashback to explain things at the end. It could have gone at the start of part two to explain what the hell they were chasing in the first film. They've stuck it at the front and then ruined all mystery for us. So it's flawed, but it's still a top tier Mission Impossible film made by a team at the peak of their powers, where if you're going to bring back Lorne Balfe, and I remember Charlie was gutted it wasn't Joe Kramer again, but at least he's made it sufficiently different from his score last time. The cinematography's not quite as lush as Rogue Nation, but it's not quite as gritty as last time. And the story is just sufficiently different, with just sufficiently new characters, but enough callbacks to make it part of a sort of organic series now.
I kind of bug you that it does look quite lush. Like, it's still, you know, it's just obviously the like, settings of that sort of thing as well. But I still think it looks like Switzerland, looks like Austria, and looks beautiful.
It's not as colourful as Rogue Nation, though. Rogue Nation was the lush sort of 60s Bond film.
I would argue the same.
Well, go and watch them back to back. I mean, look at the colour palette. Look how people are dressing.
Yeah,
look at
the opera. It's all very washed out as well.
Yeah, so. But it's not as washed out as Fallout, in my opinion. It's just an opinion.
That's just my opinion.
But that's where I am.
Only because I've seen it more recently. I think
it's absolutely terrific. It's not my favourite Mission Impossible film, though. I think there's two or three ahead of it. And that's it from me.
Becca?
Yeah, it's the same, really. I think for me, it still ranks quite highly. I'd say probably not my favourite, but still very much like in the top three, perhaps. Yeah, I keep on saying this is probably like the biggest, the most craziest in terms of the stunts as well. Everything, you know, it all kind of hits the beats. You know, McCrory does have that tick list and you can sort of feel him check it off as you go. Literally, they're going to sell you the seat and you're going to use part of it, because you will be like, oh my god, you will have that reaction when you leave the cinema. As you say, it's kind of one of the funniest films so far. You know, there's a lot more kind of like humour in it, and it does have it was meant to be like the farewell to Mission Impossible, when it, obviously they turned out, oh yeah, this is part one and part two. It was going to be, you know, the great send off for this series, and they said, oh no, we've got parts 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, in the pipeline. They're like, oh, okay, fair enough. But yeah, so, you know, he's going to continue to carry on for, you know, as you say in your review, David, however long his body holds out, definitely. It's such a shame that, you know, that Luther doesn't have more to do, but that maybe that's perhaps due to health reasons, definitely. Pumpkin Motif is hugely underused. Oh my gosh. It's a shame that she exits the film in the way she does. Hopefully we'll get to see more of her.
Yeah, I think she'll be the second one.
Yeah, I sincerely hope so as well. I kind of also hope that...
But probably as a goodie, though, this time around.
She's going to switch to the other side. She'll kind of realise that she's getting a bum deal and switch to the other side, hopefully. Because she does betray him, after all. There's lots of twists and turns. The cast here is probably one of the better ensembles that we've seen in the series as well. That's one thing that the series does really well, is kind of attract decent names. Issa Morales may not be as well known as perhaps as some of the others in the series, but you know, they at least have like really good sort of character actors as their villains, and this is probably one of the nastiest that we've seen throughout the series. Great return to form for Henry Chenier as well. You just kind of know that voice, you know, when you sort of hear him, you know, very early on in the film, you think, oh, Kittredge has returned, oh my gosh. And then some of the cameos as well, like Mark Gatiss, Zira Varma, obviously known for Big Finish. Rob Delaney in a serious role.
That could have been really jarring, couldn't it? But it was all right.
It could have been, but it worked out really well. It was actually like, seeing who was his face and name, I still can't remember. No Time to Die. Aid Edmondson popping up in the Star Wars film. Like, what's he doing here?
Sometimes it's distracting when it's one random person, but when it's actually two or three fairly random people, it just sells you a bigger world. It's like, oh, well, there's some British representatives there.
They're all kind of like, you know, British talent as well, so kind of like waving that flag, even though they some have American accents. But I just think it's fantastic, and it's a real boost for British talent as well, which is really cool. It's just testament to Tom Cruise's part. I mean, whatever you do think, you know, whether it's private life, whether it's religious beliefs, things like that, he does kind of, he can open his little black book, you know, and kind of pull all this talent together. And, you know, he's trying to do everything he can to try and really, really push that kind of big screen experience. And you know, between this and Maverick, I kind of really think he's done it, really. But yeah, I really hope they do carry on this kind of like upwards trajectory into part two, and take the series, you know, to ever more increasingly dizzying heights. But yeah, I've really had, you know, had a really good time. I mean, yes, it's four, but that's what it is. No Time to Die is the same. It's not perfect, that ending. But yeah, definitely, it's kind of, you know, one of the strongest Bond movies to date, for sure. And for this one as well, obviously, there's lots of callback to Bond, to other action movies, other action franchises, which have all been influenced by the likes of Bond and Mission Impossible. So it kind of comes almost full circle, which is only fitting, especially because the series, you know, celebrates its 30th birthday soon, which is just insane. But yeah, no, I had a fantastic time. Yeah, listeners as well, if you're listening, hearing us rant on, if you've seen it, let us know. Drop us an email, drop us a message across socials. If you hated it, let us know. If you loved it, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Anyway, Chris.
I generally enjoy it. I do enjoy this franchise, and I look forward to seeing next one. I mean, is it perfect? No. I mean, as I said, there are plot holes. There are things that don't quite make sense. You could disagree with certain. Certain decisions here and there, but ultimately it's a fun ride. I think that my main complaint, and it's always going to be a complaint, is this is a part one, and there's the next part of the story is yet to be told, so things aren't fully revealed. As you know, you might watch part two and then everything all of a sudden part one makes a heck of a lot different, may seem a heck of a lot different now, so who knows. But until then, I fully enjoyed my time with it. Yeah, definitely.
You're assuming you don't know about it, Chris, because there's a second part to come. But it might actually be the crushing lack of knowledge of this entry itself.
Well,
about that? You're assuming you understood this and it's just part two to come. But it might just be your low on factage.
Well, I didn't want to say it, but, you know.
Yeah. You're going to feel such a prat if it's that. Let's find out, Becca.
Oh gosh. Yeah, not so many fun facts. Only a few this time.
That's alright, Becca didn't understand it either.
No, I didn't understand. No, I've seen a few films, I still don't understand it. Yeah. So, yeah, one of the main train drivers, listeners, please correct me if I'm wrong, but this was heard through the grapevine from on the tractor door at its own event recently at Nene Valley Railway back in June. One of the train drivers on the Orient Express is longtime stuntman Rocky Taylor, from like Skyfall, Fast Six, and other action movies. He's uncredited on this film, but if you're a fan of obviously the Bond films, Indiana Jones, Fast and Furious movies, any sort of major stuntmans, Rocky Taylor is your man, definitely. If you've read his biography, Jump, Rocky, Jump.
Is he known as Rocky Taylor because he dresses the Thing in the Fantastic Four films?
Drum roll, please. Pow. But yeah, so I wasn't aware of this until recently, until I saw it. And I was like, oh, hey, it's Rocky Taylor. I was like, oh, how about that? Obviously, Eugene Kittredge last appeared in the first Mission Impossible film, all the way back in 1996, making him the longest absent character to return to the series. So hopefully we'll see more of him. That'll be quite interesting. Another fun fact is not really fun, but it's a long film. Films this year are getting longer and longer and longer. Obviously, tomorrow will be the 21st. We've got Oppenheimer coming out at long last, and that's 3 hours and a bit, I think. So that's going to take a cushion for that one, or book a comfy seat.
See it in an IMAX Saturday lunchtime. I'm going.
Yeah, that's going to be amazing on IMAX. Oh my gosh, are you doing a double bill with Barbie?
No, because I'm not going on my own. I was going to, but the person I'm going with doesn't want to see Barbie, so I'll have to figure something else out.
Take a comfy seat. No, I'll be seeing it soon. Yeah. But yeah, so this is the longest Mission Impossible movie in the franchise. 2 3/4 hours. The last being Fallout, which was 2.5 hours. So I wonder if the next film will probably be even longer. We shall see. And then
probably like
5 minutes.
It'll probably be like
5 minutes. They find the Sebastopol, you know, plug that thing in, go, oh, well, that's that sorted.
Gabriel dies, he vanishes into the ether.
Yeah.
And then that's it. And then, again, this is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is the first, this one, Dead Reckoning Parts 1 and 2, the first films in the franchise to be shot entirely on digital. The others have been shot on film. But I'm not entirely sure how
I'm not entirely sure. I'm fairly confident, and again, it talks to this lushness thing. I've got it in my head Rogue Nation was shot on celluloid, but I wouldn't
swear.
Yeah,
I need to double check that. So it's not really fun or a fact, so maybe a flimp.
So,
that's all I have, unfortunately.
Join us next week for our new section, Mediocre Speculation.
Mediocre flimps.
Not fun facts, mediocre speculation.
Yes, mediocre, I think this one might be, but I don't know. Mm. Anyway, that's all I have for this evening, unfortunately, because it's a very new film.
That's mediocre, folks.
That's not fun.
I have a few more fun facts.
Do you?
Go on then. Is there any fruit in this film? Yes, there is quite a lot of fruit.
Is there?
Is there?
I don't know. There must be Maybe some on the submarine.
On the train.
There's probably some freeze-dried stuff on the submarine because they're under there for a while.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Yeah, that's it. There'll probably be some fruit on on the Orient Express.
Yeah, there would have been.
So, non-fruit facts. The magic tricks that Tom Cruise did with the two halves of the key was actually done for real, like the numerous failed takes.
Oh, really? Wow.
Can you imagine, like, if after all that jumping out off planes and shit like that, like, he accidentally flicked the key into his carotid artery and that killed him?
Oh, gosh, he died.
That's the stunt that fucking did it. I read that. Apparently, it took quite a few takes.
Yeah. And, again, you don't think that because you're always thinking about the stunts, but of course he's going to fucking do that. Of course it's like, oh, no, I'll just do, like, a real magic trick. Yeah, fuck that.
That's probably why he doesn't do sex scenes. He's got, no, I've got to do it for real and I have to finish.
apparently, obviously, with the COVID during filming, Tom Cruise actually paid out of his own pocket £500,000.
Yeah.
For a cruise ship just for everyone to isolate on.
That is crazy, isn't it? Oh my gosh.
And get this for a fact, right? So John Voight in the first Mission Impossible is actually younger than Tom Cruise is now.
Wow.
So at the time, John Voight was 57.
And Tom Cruise was, 59 when they wrapped, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh my God, so he's now older.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
John Voight always had a kind of older air to him. I don't mean he always looked like he was 60. I don't mean that at all. But, like, after Midnight Cowboy, literally everything I ever saw him in, he was like middle-aged man. Do you know what I mean? Even before
he
was.
Yeah, he played those sort of roles, didn't he?
Yeah. But there you go.
That is crazy, isn't it? How time flies. That's just
Disrespect, Becca, but that's fun, folks.
That is real fun factage, Chris. I've dropped the ball on this occasion. Chris, you are the fun fact legend for this episode. I will try to retain my title next time.
All right. Before we go any further, social media, you can find me at ThePastyKid1976 on Twitter.
You can find me at Cinematronics. You can also find all the old episodes on Podbean. It should be all there.
You can find us on Twitter at Expect Us to Talk, on YouTube, Do You Expect Us to Talk? You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Stitcher, on Podbean, on Podbay. Basically, wherever you find your podcatchers, wherever you get your podcasts. But if I could just ask you, dear listeners, lean in very close. I've got a secret to tell you. Are you listening? So yes, wherever you are, don't forget to rate, review, like, and share us on your podcatcher of choice, because it helps us to rank higher up the charts and attract more listeners.
Awesome. Okay, so we're going on to a new series now. And we agreed it, tonight. So, it's not one we've ever mentioned, but it's going to be short, because as we said, we're going to do a couple of these. It's one more than that. It's a series which is going to make a long-awaited return in the coming months. We're then going to do a Bond show, and then we are going to go on to do some sort of flavour of Alfred Hitchcock season, but that's going to be long-ish. We're not going to do everything he ever did, because who wants to hear everything he ever did except from the most diehard fans? But we are going to do a selection that it'll be themed one way or another.
If you want to hear about anything he ever did, I can highly recommend listening to Good Evening Pod, hosted by Chris Haig and his team. I think they cover the entire episode.
They have. But I mean, exhaustive depth. I mean, I subscribed and like months after I subscribed to it, they were still on the silent ones, and I was like, come on, can we get to the talkies now, please?
Yeah, they're doing everything. Episodes of the of the TV show as well, which is amazing. But yeah, I can definitely recommend another one. Is Hitchpod from Australia. I think they just focus on the Good Evening one.
Anyone who's ever sort of followed us around on things we've guested on, Chris Haig used to appear with me and Chris quite a lot on, what was it called?
Smorgasbord.
Yeah,
that was the show.
He was on that like almost as much as I was. He was on it very regularly, so you will have heard him. He's very good at it. Podcasting, that is. I haven't tried anything else with him. Becca, where are we going next?
Do you expect us to talk or return with our review of Beverly Hills Cop?